Good morning, good morning. Are we ready? Are we ready?
Oh boy. Chris asked me why they didn't talk about the white fighting last night. I said because that's on our agenda. It's on the agenda. They have to wait for the agenda.
That's exactly right. Good morning. And welcome, ladies and gentlemen. This is the second day of the 86th public meeting of the D.A. Buchanan Independent Safety Committee. The first item on our agenda is committee members' remarks and comments. Dr. Peterson and Dr. Butness. With no committee members' comments, the next item on our agenda is public comments on any item not on our agenda. Members of the public who wishes to address the committee on matters of their choice, please come to the podium and identify yourself. Hearing none, let us go to the next item on our agenda, which is information items requested by the committee to PG&E. And now may I introduce Mr. Kerry Harbour, the Director of Generation Risk and Compliance. Mr. Harbour has a big portfolio, including all forms of electricity production within PG&E. Mr. Harbour, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. So our first topic today is a state of the plant update to provide the committee with an update of activities at Diablo Canyon since the last public meeting. And then items that will be proceeding forward to the next 6 months of the year. And presenting will be Paula Gerfin, our station director. And Paula has a Bachelor of Science degree in computer science, has well over 25 years of nuclear experience, and has had leadership roles in digital systems, maintenance, and operations. With that, I'll have Paula come on up.
Good morning and welcome.
Good morning. How are you gentlemen this morning? Good. Okay, so it looks like we're having a little technical difficulty here with our slides.
They changed laptops last night and the stuff I had loaded
Okay, gentlemen, if you're ready to go, I'll give my state of the plant update. So essentially, if I can go to the next. So current status of the plant, Unit 1 and both Unit 1 and Unit 2 are operating 100% power. We have no challenges to generation or core damage frequency at this time. As you can see, all of our NRC performance indicators are green. Unit 1, over 2016, actually generation capacity was higher than anticipated, and you can look at efficiencies in the plant and ocean conditions that got us above 100%. And on Unit 2, we did curtail, as you're going to see in the next couple of slides, we had to do a pick and dredge due to storms and ocean conditions that challenged Unit 2 in particularly. So next slide, Brian. So for last month, we had to curtail both units to 55% power with one of the recent storms, and that was due to pick and dredge in the condensers. Ocean debris fouled the main condensers, and so we just had to clean those off and come back up. And on Unit 2, we have done that twice in the recent past. Both evolutions were done successfully, no issues with the operating crew, and came back to 100% power to a much more reliable condenser. Next slide. Again, this is a capacity factor over the last 4 months. You can see the only challenges we had were the ones I just discussed for the curtailments. And then the next slide will show the same information basically over the last 12 months. You can see the stations, both units have been running in a very reliable manner. Next slide, Brian. Okay, so 1R20 is our next refueling outage that starts on April 23rd. It is currently scheduled for 75 days. 6 days of that is contingency, and the main issue that is causing that large duration is dealing with our baffle bolt inspection, which you gentlemen are very, very intimate with. And so what these four items are the challenges that we're working through to ensure that we have excellent performance over that inspection. And nothing there is insurmountable. We're working with vendors to get a new bolt replacement tool sent in from Germany. And this outage could go, we could find, we're focusing on replacing 200 bolts maximum, and that's what's driving the duration of the activity. Next slide. So I don't know how much have you gentlemen have been informed on our Cobalt 60 challenge on Unit 1, if you're aware of that. The root cause did complete, and the highly probable cause of the Cobalt 60 issue is coming out of 1R18, we had a problem with rectocoolant pump 1-3. We had a shaft alignment issue, and we got all the way up to 93% power. And then with the problem with the rectocoolant pump, we had to come back down in power, go to a mode 5 outage, and replace the seal on that rectocoolant pump. But what we did find is with that shaft misalignment, there was stellite on some of the components that were affected. So when the stellite goes through the RCS and it becomes activated on the fuel, it becomes cobalt 60, highly radioactive, and that's what has increased our source term on that unit.
How did you detect the problem with the pump seal? Was it vibration or heat or?
So it presented itself as we were coming up in power as an increased seal leak off flow.
Okay.
Yeah, that's how it presented itself to the crew. We monitored it, and because sometimes when you're coming up out of an outage, you see that, but it settles out with the reactor coolant pumps, you know, as you come up in power. But this one obviously did not. There was a problem with the shaft alignment.
Okay, and then fixing that required some realignment of the shaft, or what was the corrective action?
So there was a root cause that was done on that, and there were issues with our maintenance procedure that we had. It allowed the maintenance workers to maybe not be as prescriptive as they needed to be with measurements that were done. And so we went in, we improved the procedure, worked with the vendor, more oversight, and replaced that seal. And what we have in the procedure now is completely sustainable, and we won't be seeing that issue again.
That's good. One last question. When you say misaligned, dimensionally, what does that mean? I mean, what sort of tolerances are you looking at?
Very, very small tolerances.
Millimeter range.
But when you're talking about a very large shaft being off by a little bit, as it translates down through the length of the shaft, it becomes more of a problem down at the bottom. And that's what caused the wear on bearings, et cetera, that generated the stellite cobalt issue.
Yeah. Paula, when I'm not alone on this table saying that when that root cause thing is done, of course, we'll look at it.
Yes.
Because it really seemed like, I won't use the word an oddball event, but sort of an unexpected obviously it was unexpected. You didn't expect it. And I remember that those tolerance differences were in the millimeter range.
That's correct. Mm-hmm.
So simple question is there any operating experience elsewhere with those exact same things around the world that
With having that issue with the reactor coolant pump seals?
Yeah.
You know, that's a very good question.
And we asked this question whenever it was. What, it was 2 years ago or whatever?
It was 1R18. That was so 2014.
Yeah, okay. So it was coming up to 3 years ago. And I remembered at the time saying you didn't think there was, but now we've had a lot of time to look and see whether there's any OE that – and anybody else that's, that experienced
it. So the root cause was just completed yesterday.
Okay, so we'll see it soon.
Yeah, you'll see it. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Right.
I mean, I just wondered whether the vendor Mannheim had seen anything like that. Oh, no, it wasn't Mannheim. I'm sorry. That's a different thing.
Right.
I just wonder where the vendor of the
well,
the seals
the vendor is completely aware that there are stellate components in the situation.
Sure.
Right. But it's just having an awareness of when you have challenges.
So it hadn't, but it hadn't apparently appeared anywhere else.
I cannot respond to that, yes or no.
Okay. In any event, now that you've got this, everybody in the world is going to be looking at this and
that's
see
correct.
Where it applies to them.
Right.
And you didn't have any extent of condition anywhere else in the plant?
Well, so the extent of condition is you would look and determine all the other components
right.
that are in the RCS that
exactly
have stellate.
Right. Exactly
and,
right.
But we have no issues. We have awareness of the content, and when you go in to do maintenance, you will take
right.
mitigating actions to
but
prevent
But you didn't
it.
See any other
no.
failure?
No. Right.
You know, this is another indication of how difficult and how challenging. This is really one indication of how difficult and how challenging this technology is. You're dealing with tolerances of millimeter range on the equipment, which is huge.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's continuously operating, and it is remarkable that this issue has surfaced after so many years of operation.
Yeah, well, but Peter, as you know, we deal with tiny tolerances in large engineered systems all the time. I'm flying home tonight in a gadget that whose engines have such tolerances, and I assume it's going to be okay.
Oh, yeah, sure. You know, mm-hmm. This is really, this is only one example, right? And
sure.
there would be numerous other examples as well.
Right. Okay, let's go to the next slide. Oh, so at the end, the last quarter of 2016, we had another round of our station alignment workshops. And again, the intent of having these workshops is to align the entire organization on our path forward and key issues that, as a station, we're addressing. And so we had another one, and every single person on site was a member of participated in the site alignment workshops, including our independent contractor that we have on site. So it wasn't just Jabal Canyon; it was our contractor team also participated in it. So we all have clear alignment on path forward and what we're striving for in our operating plan, et cetera. And so that was our third round of alignment workshops. And we started doing those, and we have seen great success in keeping all of our employees aligned with our path forward, from individual contributor on up to the vice president. So that's the point of doing those workshops. Next slide. Okay, is Gerald Strickland here yet? There you are. Gerald, I'd appreciate it if you spoke to the slide. I don't have great insights on this. Thank you very much.
Good morning. I'm Gerald Strickland, as you know well. I'll give you just a little bit of insight as to where we are today, that we finally received the letter from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission accepting the ground motion response spectra that we had submitted a little over a year prior. And in turn, what that did is that then provided us the ability to be able to move on with the next steps in the evaluation process. So while we were waiting for the letter from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, we had gone forth and we had created all new models of our structures, systems, and components that are important to safety, and built those into an updated seismic probabilistic risk assessment tool. So with that then, what we are in the process of proceeding with is completing the initial runs of the new seismic probabilistic risk assessment using updated fragilities and in turn are making good progress toward a fall submittal to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission on our findings. Any questions I can answer?
Yeah. You had done all the preliminary work waiting for that final NRC endorsement, so you were just ready to go with completing the rest of that. And I assume that the schedule is just what you've been telling us right along. That is, another month or two, you're going to have an outside peer review of experts and then feed that back in.
Correct. We've established a schedule for external peer review. I had part of our team back at the Indian Point peer review that took place this week.
Oh, great, great.
And so with that, we're trying to make sure that
you understand the process and everything.
That not only understand the process, but that we learn from what others have contributed to the process.
And that peer review is against the ASME ANS standard and the SPID, right?
That's correct.
Right.
Now, when you mention new models, does it mean improve and more realistic models when
yes
you say new?
Yes and yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right? It's interesting that as you know, my history that this is my 38th year with PG&E, and time flies. And so I've seen the progression from what we used when we originally modeled the plant up into what the tools that are available today. And that today, with being able to do the very detailed finite element models of all the structures, that it really provides a lot of additional insight and, in turn, gives you the ability to be able to do a lot more when it comes to seismic evaluations.
And also, a priori, when you implement these new models, you really do not know what the outcome would be. You take the outcome as they come, right? Even if it turned out to be predicting less margin. I'm just thinking out loud.
Right? Yes, and that's part of the overall process that's been established by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, that as you do this evaluation, you start with the new models, you develop new fragilities for each of the pieces of equipment that are important to safety, as well as structural components and elements. And then from there, you compare it to what you had back in the IEEE evaluation. And in some cases, fragilities have gone up. Some cases, they've come down. And so this gives you the ability to go back and reassess the overall margins of all of the important components of the plant, be it structure systems or specific components. And so so with it, if you look at the overall process that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission set up with this, that there are a number of plants out there that after they complete the review end up implementing a number of modifications to the plant to be able to improve safety margins in specific areas. And so we'll go through the same type of evaluation process.
Right. So basically you take, you take where the chips fall, where it may, right? And the reason my inquiry is, I'm sure you're aware, we had public comments saying, when this facility is in a pinch, you go back and sharpen its pencil and reiterate. Right? I mean, we had seen some submission yesterday near the end of the session going down on that line speculation and hypothesis. So my inquiry today is just to add another dimension to this discussion, that this facility is continuously improving its method and models of calculation and analysis, and whatever the outcome is, you would accept that. You're not really trying to sharpen the pencil and reiterate, find out where would it be more beneficial to your position.
Yeah, I agree with that statement. And that Diablo Canyon's in a better position than many other plants around the nation in that we do have a very detailed long-term seismic program that's been in place since we entered operation. And so with it, that we've continued to update the seismic hazard and in turn understand what that input is. If you look at a number of the other plants around the nation, when they completed the 5054 Foxtrot evaluations, what they found is that the new seismic inputs that they had to evaluate using probabilistic tools were substantially higher than what the plants were originally designed for. We didn't fall into that category, so we're in a much better position than other facilities.
So really, a priori, you really did not know if this improved modeling would lead to a more favorable results for your position, right? You take the results whatever the outcome is.
Yeah. I'll tell you that as you get better models, that you the results are more definitive, I'll call it, in that that the tools are much more sophisticated and much more accurate than what you've seen in the past.
But it does not necessarily lead to a better safety margin for you, right? I mean, whatever it leads to.
Yeah, right. you'd whatever the results are, right. That we will right. appropriately right. address them. Right. Yes, sir.
I just want to clarify something that to me is really important. I'm as sure as I can be, I know the answer, but I'm going to ask the question. The analysis of the containment or the turbine building or a pump or a motor control system cabinet does not start with the design basis of that cabinet, but starts with the cabinet as it sits or the structure as it sits and starts with that analysis, quite separate from how it might have been designed in the last millennium.
Correct.
So the design basis of that is not a part of your consideration of this analysis. It's the thing as it sits, which, by the way, as I understand it, and because I've been following this for a while, some of the equipment that you have out there, you know how strong it is because it's been tested on a
right.
shaker table.
Shake table tested.
Some structures you can't test, so they're done by analysis.
Correct.
Some mix of that, right?
And it's interesting. You look at some of the drivers within the analysis, and it can be simply an electrical box on the wall that has the lowest margins that then drives the overall results in a specific component or portion of that seismic probabilistic risk assessment.
Yeah, so. I understand that.
So I'd like to step back just a bit and place this into broader context, given that the office that I sit in was a building 5 stories tall, built to 1960s code, and it's located about 400 feet from the most dangerous fault that is around any university in the world, and probably in the state of California, with a 70% or so chance
the
of failing.
Hayward Fault.
Right. And what I can tell you is that the level of work that's being done here is absolutely and spectacularly better than what is being done with regard to the hazards that we face in a location that has a very high population density, and that our ability to retrofit things when we find that they are unsafe is much worse. So we have a list of buildings. The campus has taken on substantial amount of debt because the state of California has disinvested from seismic safety upgrades. And so if you look at the structural deficit that the campus has, which is about $150 million per year, it's equal, almost perfectly equal, to the interest that we're paying on debt that we've taken on to do seismic retrofit to buildings. And we're only partway through that list.
And one important point to note with that is that when you look at the qualification of those structures that are housing our future with our students and our faculty, in that they're designed simply for life safety, which means that under a large seismic event, their focus simply is that structure is going to stand up and be able to allow the occupants to be able to exit. And the facility will probably not be usable in the future. You look at a nuclear power plant, and it's completely different, to where we're required to be designed such that after a design-based seismic event, that the plant can be safely shut down and maintained in a safe shutdown position after that major seismic event. So the structural design requirements are substantially different between the two.
And so, you know, one of the things that I think is quite interesting is that here at Diablo Canyon, the level of sophistication in terms of the seismic analysis is enormous. And particularly looking at understanding ground motion, we've started to do just a little bit of that in the Bay Area. So, for example, some of the modeling that Los Alamos or Livermore did in the last decade or so looked at seismic events on the Hayward Fault and discovered that there would be a reflected wave coming back off of Mount Tam. Hmm. And at the exact time that it would hit the Bay Bridge, it was during the point when the Bay Bridge was at the point of maximum deflection and therefore would break the Bay Bridge. And as a result of doing that analysis, they went and fixed the part that had to take the high stresses, greatly reducing the probability that we would lose that, because you know that's a huge impact on the Bay. But more pervasively, we continuously underinvest in this area of seismic safety, except when we're talking about nuclear power plants. And I'm a little bit disappointed when I step back and look at the bigger picture in terms of seismic hazard, that we seem to be so focused on just small elements of the overall infrastructure, and we tend to be willing to ignore the rest.
Hold on. I don't want to leave unsaid something that to me is real important. The sophisticated methods used here are also used, for example, on the Bay Bridge. We've reanalyzed the Golden Gate Bridge. The BART tunnel, by the way, underneath it is being upgraded right now, seismic safety, based on new analysis. The most important lifelines where I live in around the Bay have, in fact, been analyzed using these more sophisticated methods, too. We're not underinvesting in those things, thankfully. But, boy, there's a lot for which there really isn't proper investment. But we're talking about this power plant. Power plant, as best I can tell, is using the modern approaches, which we wouldn't settle for less.
So one other point I'd like to share is that we've talked in the past about the applications of smart meters around the PG&E system, that we've made good progress now in being able to take the next steps to put in accelerometers in smart meters. And so with that, the intent is to be able to have large databases to be able to then take the input from small earthquakes around the region and be able to use that to help characterize the ground motion models that Norm Abrahamson has been continuing to refine and develop through time. So we're also looking at taking the next steps of being able to then put accelerometers on pieces of equipment around the PG&E system so that, again, items that may not have ever been shake table tested, that you're able to then get more definitive information on how those various pieces of equipment behave during a seismic event.
Thanks
so we're looking at trying to expand further and use the state of the knowledge that we've been able to develop for Diablo and apply it across the system.
Dr. Peterson?
So then in the grand scheme of things, the number of lives that you can save through this work that you've been doing here is enormous. If you can see them translated and used elsewhere, particularly up in the Bay Area, since it's so dangerous up there. And I really appreciate that you've been doing that. Thank you.
Thank you.
After listening to Dr. Peterson and Dr. Butness, I am getting a warm feeling that this may be the safest place in the state of California during an earthquake.
I've said a number of times before, if there was a major earthquake in this region, that I'd prefer to be at Diablo than any place else.
You agree, right? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so now you understood why I phoned a friend on that one.
Right.
So that concludes my presentation. If you have any more questions for me.
Comments from a committee member?
But we've got, then we ask the public.
Sure. Public comments on what our speaker has presented?
John Eastman on behalf of the Alliance for Nuclear Responsibility. I want to initially respond to Dr. Peterson. in terms of relative earthquake risk and the need for detailed seismic analysis. And I think you know this, but the 1982 Sandia study, the so-called Crack 2 study, attributed to a peak accident at Diablo Canyon, presumably seismic was a plausible initiator of such a peak accident, 10,000 deaths within the first year attributed to a breach at either reactor, and property damage off-site, $313 billion in 1982 dollars. Now, if I escalate that to 2016 dollars, that's $775 billion of off-site property damage. And that doesn't account for any increase in development around the plant since 1982. I'm not going to address the death questions because obviously, according to the census, the population has grown since then. But there's a good reason why the analysis is required to be so much more intensive here at this plant. And the comparison to earthquake risk in the Bay Area, while an important one, in terms of a single point source of risk, is simply incomparable. And the level of rigor that needs to be brought to this plant, which the NRC regards as far and away the most seismically challenged plant in the United States, is appropriate. Now, with respect to what Mr. Strickland said, I would like to ask how much of that analysis will be made public and when. And as Dr. Budnitz was saying yesterday, with regard to why the NRC has downplayed the safe shutdown earthquake and instead considered the Hosgri earthquake evaluation an acceptable substitute despite the differences in soil structure interaction assumptions, accident loading assumptions, and damping assumptions, I think it would go a long way with the public if that analysis were ever made public and subject to external peer review so that the math could be checked. So my question for Mr. Strickland, in terms of the potential for modifications that he mentioned after this analysis is completed later this year, will those be modifications to comply with the existing safe shutdown earthquake standard, or will the safe shutdown earthquake standard be defined differently going forward on the basis of this new analysis? Thank you.
John, I can answer the question before he does, and then he gets to answer for that.
I can answer the question, and then PG&E can answer too. It's my understanding, because the other plants are doing this too, that that's all those analyses are going to be in the docket and therefore available to anyone in the public. PG&E, the other plants too, have an outside peer review group of independent experts that's going to review this. I mentioned that a few minutes ago before they submit it, but then it could be available for anybody to review.
And is that peer review made public as well?
I believe so, but we'll ask PG&E. I think so, but PG&E can answer. Okay. That's my understanding, but obviously they'll tell you. It's submitted. It's part of the submittal.
That peer review is required to be submitted to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission as part of the public record. So,
Along with the analysis itself.
Along with the analysis itself. And try and answer Mr. Giesman's question associated with how we would treat any evaluations going forward, that any of the work that we do, we look at the design earthquake input, double design earthquake input, the Hosgri input, and then we compare against long-term seismic program. And so we look at all the various different seismic inputs to be able to evaluate any structure, system, or component. So when I talk about potential for modifications, that if we get to the point through that analysis that says that there's opportunities to be able to add additional margin in specific areas, then what it would be is we'd go back and we'd evaluate it against the new seismic input that was just developed, and also, as part of the process, compare it against those other inputs I just noted.
But just to be sure I understand, if one were to say that that old SSE from God knows when was the basis, that would be incorrect.
That's incorrect. We were required as part of the...
You got to look at that, among other things.
We have to go back and we have to evaluate any evaluation of the plant, any modification of the plant for each of the various different earthquakes with the various acceptance criteria for each of those.
And each one, they have, by the way, they have different dampings and different other...
Correct. All different
so
inputs.
There's a whole range of things.
And if you actually went back and tried to look at the dampening that was specified for design earthquake, double design earthquake, and compared it to the dampening that's used today, that it's not consistent with state of the art practice.
Right. Thank you. Thank you.
Maybe I should just make one additional comment related to this question of risk and risk management, and in response to Mr. Giesman's important point that nuclear facilities are required to have higher levels of strength under earthquakes because of the fact that the consequence of failure can be substantially higher than, say, having a office building collapse that has occupants in it. That said, when you adjust for those factors in terms of relative risk, return frequency, and you go up and you take a look at the situation up in the Bay Area in terms of societal investment in earthquake safety, it doesn't meet a reasonable standard for what the state of California really should be doing, in my own judgment. And I think that we have buildings that we're not sure that they have adequate life safety still. And we do know that we have buildings that we won't be able to reoccupy, so we won't be able to restart classes. And we're not completely sure if we'll be able to sustain the institution there following the earthquake that is almost certainly going to happen within the next 30 to 40 years on the Hayward Fault. At this point, I think the key thing is that we also have to be diligent to make sure that this plant is safe. But I would just go back and point out that the way that we looked at these problems back in the 1980s was not nearly as sophisticated and had serious deficiencies compared to the way that we look at these problems today. And taking these methods and applying them more broadly across the rest of our civil infrastructure is very much the right thing for us to be doing. Okay, thank you.
Additional public comments on our two speakers?
Hello, good to see everybody again. My name is William Glogge. I'm with Californians for Green Nuclear Power, here representing Mother Earth and the citizens that live in this area and live in California and live on planet Earth. We had a scenario of what might happen if there was an earthquake and the risk to business and property and life. We actually had a test of that scary scenario in Fukushima with one of the worst earthquakes that mankind has ever seen, 9.0. And what happened there? Did this scenario work out? There must have been millions of people killed and businesses wiped off the face of the map. The fact of the matter is not a single person was killed in that horrendous earthquake. There were design flaws in that plant. You experts all know about that. The way it was built so close to the sea level. So we have a test. We have a test we can look at. Zero people were killed by the reactor incident that happened because of a tsunami. So there was loss in businesses and there was loss of life, but it was all due to government overreaction. People were moved out of intensive care and hospitals to high school gymnasiums, and they couldn't survive in that condition. So a lot of people did die, older people that were on life support systems and others. Businesses were wiped out because governments told them, get the hell out of there, leave your business. I saw a video of one farmer that stayed, and all his farm animals were fine, and the radiation levels were not that big a deal. And people came back and tested radiation levels in their homes and said, why did they force us to leave? They're near normal radiation levels, not like less than flying in an airplane. So, you know, we need to put all this in context. These scary scenarios that people are paid tens of thousands of dollars to come up with and represent here. We need to look at real life situations, and Fukushima is our model to look at, the worst possible thing that could happen to a nuclear reactor. And again, nobody died, and the UN says no one will die or be ill from released radiation. So there, you know, think of the contrast here. And then finally, remember that global warming is the real threat. What if we placed fossil fuel under the kind of scrutiny that you people give nuclear? Wouldn't that be a wonderful day to do that? We could get some real horror stories going, and we could show you dead bodies, millions of them, that suffer because of the option to nuclear power, fossil fuel. Well, thank you very much, and thank you for your work. And I just say, put everything in context, in the true context, for the benefit of the citizens. Thank you.
Thank you. Additional public comments on our speakers?
Yes. My name is Joseph Ivora. I'm a retired PG&E employee. Anyway, I come up with some good news about the U.S. nuclear reactors. They have the highest capacity factor in the world. In the last 15 years, they're above 92%. The largest reactor in the world is actually in Canada. It's a CANDU reactor. And let's see, I lost my thought here. Well, I guess I have to state something that Marie Curie said, nothing in life is to be feared, it is only to be understood. Nothing, now is the time to understand, more so than we may fear less. I mean, nuclear power is the way to go, folks, and I don't know why we keep our world, the U.S. actually, resists this wonderful invention by mankind. It's the most powerful, the cleanest, the nicest to the environment, to the plant life, to the animal life. We don't kill birds or bats or bees like wind power or the Ivan Paul has a record of killing some people say 6,000 birds. The Auburn Society says 3,500 birds. Diablo Canyon kills zero. They don't harm the tortoises. We need power. We need power. We need solar and wind, but we need nuclear power. So if any of you folks can somehow help us educate some of the folks. So I have to say thank you. Thank you for your service.
Thank you for your remarks. Additional public comments on our last two speakers. Mr. Harper, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the next topic that we have to present to the committee is on the NRC white finding associated with the adequacy of valve work instructions. And that will be presented to us today by Tom Baldwin, our Director of Site Services. Tom also has a Bachelor of Science degree in Mechanical Engineering and has well over 30 years of nuclear experience and has held leadership roles in engineering and operations and various support organizations. So with that, I'll hand it over to Tom.
Thank you, Gary.
Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you for having me back. Today I'd like to talk about a condition we discovered during our last refueling outage last summer. And to give you some background, this was something we discovered during our testing that we conduct. We conduct extensive testing of all of our equipment during refueling outages to ensure that it is capable of performing its intended function. And we do that as often as we can. In this case, this could only be tested during a refueling outage to ensure we have highly reliable equipment that will work when, if such an event occurs that it is demanded. In this particular case, what we're talking about is a test that we performed that attempted to open a motor-operated valve, and the valve did not open. This particular valve is part of what we call the emergency core cooling system. The emergency core cooling system is a system that is normally on standby, and in the event that a pipe inside containment, a reactor coolant system pipe, small or large, were to break, what would happen would be a reactor trip would be initiated, and the plant would be shut down, and the emergency core cooling system would activate, and it would start pumping borated water into the reactor coolant system to keep the reactor safely shut down and quench the nuclear reaction. Now, in the later phases of such an event, what we would do is the large inventory that we have available to put into the containment to the reactor coolant system would eventually be depleted, and we would realign the system to take suction off of containment where all of the water that we have pumped in has started to accumulate, and we would draw from containment that water, we would cool it, and we would re-inject it into the reactor coolant system. In this case, we have two separate paths out of containment, and these paths are isolated by these particular valves. We'll call it, its identifier is the 8982. And we have two of these. They're 100% capacity. Either one of them will more than adequately mitigate such an event. We test all of the valves, and in this last outage, we tested these valves. And as I mentioned, 8982 Bravo, the second train, did not open on demand. The other train did. So at the end of the day, had that system been called upon, we would have had one of the trains working. We looked at that, we promptly investigated, and we found that a related valve that normally is open and provides the water flow path from our large inventory of borated water has a position switch on it. That position switch tells the control system that we have closed that normal flow path from our large inventory, and it allows the valve to containment to open. In this case, that switch had been broken, and therefore it couldn't sense that we had first closed the valve from our normal large inventory of borated water, thereby allowing us to open the valve to containment.
Could you say a little bit more about what you mean by the switch was broken? I mean, what physically was wrong?
So physically, all the valves were always capable of electrically stroking the valve itself, open or closed. However, this switch is an interlock, because what we don't want to do is, during normal operation, while the normal valve is open, allow the valve to containment to open. At that point, all of the water from this borated supply would flow into containment and flood containment.
Correct. But what was wrong with the switch? The switch itself.
So the switch itself. The switch itself is the manufacturer's a Namco. It's a snap action limit switch. And its travel arm, it's got a sensing arm that has a tripper finger that pushes on it as the valve strokes. So as it strokes closed, it would push this arm, and it will snap a set of contacts, making up a new electrical circuit that allows the logic to open the other valve. Mm-hmm. And in this case, the finger had pushed too far, and it had snapped a small roll pin that connects that lever arm to the circuitry.
Okay.
So something was broken.
It was broken.
Okay.
It broke the switch.
It broke the switch. Mm-hmm. So we investigated that. We promptly repaired it. We identified it. We could see that it was broken. We replaced the switch. We tested. In that refueling outage, everything worked fine. We recognized that was unexpected. We inspected all of the other valves that have this kind of a switch. We found none of them broken. We found none of them in a condition where they could be pushed too far. And we continued to investigate. We found that two refueling outages prior, we had performed maintenance on that valve and its switch, and we had actually successfully tested that valve and its switch, that outage, showing that it could perform its function. We stroke that valve every quarter, and that every time we stroke that valve, it actuates the switch. We don't have remote indication of that switch online, but during refueling outages, we prove that that switch is making up its electrical circuit. The next outage, we similarly did perform the test. This is two outages now, back now. We performed the test, and again, it functioned. It worked perfectly. This outage, back in May, we performed the test and it didn't. When we investigated, we found that the finger had gone too far, and although going too far would not necessarily fail the switch, the repeated actuations of pushing too far eventually led to failure. So the NRC, performing their oversight, identified that there's guidance from the manufacturer on their website that says, under all circumstances, make sure you don't travel that finger too far. And we recognized we didn't have that check in our procedures. We had failed to set up the travel to limit it to its acceptable range of travel to ensure that we couldn't break the switch.
And this switch has been there for 45 years, ever since day one?
I would have to go do some investigation to say when was the last time that switch itself was replaced. It is original plant design. We've used these switches in the system since before we started operating.
Right, so it has been there for a long time.
Absolutely.
And it passes tests every time until now.
That's correct. Okay. We do not have a history of failure of these switches. We've looked back. We have these switches on a number of our motor-operated valves, and we, as I said, routinely test them every refueling outage, and we have not had similar failures of these ECCS interlock switches all the way back to 1991 when we set up our motor-operated valve program. So we did identify and recognize that we did have a deficient procedure. The intent of the motor-operated valve program was to identify all critical switches and capabilities of our safety-related motor-operated valves and ensure that they would remain capable of performing their safety function. We recognized that there are many switches in the program, such as torque switches, internal limit switches. Those were all captured. These external limit switches were only being verified by an audible click to say they've snapped open. The finger has traveled far enough. It has made up the logic. What we didn't check was that it clicked and it's not going too far. That not going too far was an aspect we had not picked up when we set up our program. We've changed our procedures and are preparing to perform our next refueling outage, where we will go and implement those new procedures and verify no overtravel. Meanwhile, we are verifying under normal circumstances, under normal online testing, that the valves that we test online also do not overtravel. And as I said, we had checked this back last summer as well for all of the valves, so we do remain highly confident that all the valves are properly set up, and this deficiency in the procedure had not resulted in other valves being improperly set. We do coordinate this particular trip point of where the finger trips the switch with an internal limit switch on the valve itself called a rotor and a motor-operated valve. Those are coordinated. So that provides a level of assurance that they are normally acceptably configured. In this particular case, something had not been properly set and it did over-travel. The NRC did come to a final determination on the significance of this performance deficiency, of the procedure deficiency, and the resultant failed valve. And they concluded that it was low to moderate risk significance based on the methodology they apply to assess what's the potential of that valve to have caused a problem with respect to a significant accident. And as I said, they concluded low to moderate significance. They issued that final determination in December. That means that there will be an additional inspection from the NRC. They will come in when we tell them we're ready. And to tell them we're ready, we've performed a root cause evaluation, which is our most significant, most in-depth cause evaluation to really understand the full depth and breadth of the problem and ensure that we never experience one of these again. And we've performed that evaluation. I've told you where this problem came from. We are evaluating other vulnerabilities in that program and fixing other procedures that could have similar vulnerabilities. The NRC will come in, perform a 95001 inspection, that's their inspection procedure, against our root cause evaluation. Now, you may be aware we also submitted an appeal. The appeal is really not about the performance deficiency and the procedure gap. We own that. This was not an acceptable performance to us in any way, shape, or form. We are committed to the safe operation and maintenance of this power plant, and as such, we put a lot of effort into extensively reviewing the event and putting proof positive in place that we cannot re-experience this. In addition, the training and procedures of our operators, should an event like this have occurred, does provide additional avenues for opening these valves. These are motor-operated valves. This control logic I talked about with the interlock is bypassable. The operators have procedures that allow them to either go down locally to the valve, and you see a picture of the individual, one of our operators at the valve, with there's a hand wheel on it. They can manually open the valve. Additionally, an alternate way would be for an operator to go downstairs from the control room to the motor-operated valve breaker cubicle, open the cover, and press some contactors. Those contact, you'd hold them in, that would activate the motor and would start stroking closed. There are a couple of methods that are pretty simple for our trained operators that are familiar with both of these methods and trained on both of these methods to have opened that valve. As I said, we also had the redundant train, proof positive. It was fully capable and available for us to use should an event have occurred. So at no time was the public actually in a position where an event could have occurred that this valve would have resulted in us failing to mitigate an accident. We remained capable of mitigating the event all the time.
Were there any diversity in all the trains? When you talk about redundancy, Mr. Bowman.
Yeah,
So they are identical trains with identical equipment with the same vulnerability, except this particular switch happened to fail.
That's correct.
The other switches were okay, right, over all these years. Okay.
Mm-hmm. They had been all properly set up. This was not a physical defect of the switch. This was an inappropriate configuration of our performing maintenance.
Right, right. But on the other redundant trains, you had the same switches subject to the same maintenance procedures.
Yes, we do.
Okay. So there was no diversity there, okay.
Correct.
Only redundancy, okay.
So the plant identifies large numbers of problems every year.
Mm-hmm.
If I remember, the statistic is 24,000 notifications filed each year by employees. And the employees, everybody's encouraged to report these events, and as has happened here, this has ended up being classified as white, and some people feel that perhaps the safety significance was higher and it should be treated more seriously. But there's this question, if the NRC does not classify the majority of problems that are found at nuclear plants as being minor safety significance, what impact does that have on the willingness of employees to report?
The significance of the finding really doesn't influence our plant staff. We actively encourage our people and thank them for writing notifications, for identifying problems. We pride ourselves in maintaining a safety culture and an environment that is appreciative of our employees that do identify problems or opportunities to improve. It runs a spectrum from we could do something better to this is unacceptable, we have to stop right now what we're doing and fix it now.
Mm-hmm.
We give our employees the permission to stop a job if they feel it's unsafe, and we make it safe for them to do that. The significance from the NRC of a problem being judging it minor, green, white, really does not have an impact on our employees and their willingness to step up and identify a problem. Really, the willingness of our employees to step up and identify and document problems is on the environment we create at the station to make it safe and value and pride safety and our speak-up culture.
Right. But the Department of Energy regulates nuclear facilities as well, and perhaps is not so disciplined in the classification of events. And there's some reasons why you can argue that in some ways that may create a chilled environment for reporting problems if the regulatory agency. Then you get to the next question, which is you want to see problems reported at very minor levels. How do you assess whether they're being fixed, which is the real question? So what gives you confidence that this was something that there were no opportunities to catch it before, so that it wouldn't have happened this time, and that it won't happen again in one way or form in the future?
Well, as I said, so just to speak first to what gives us confidence that it would be fixed in a timely manner, at this point this is prioritized in our corrective action program as a very high significant, our top level corrective action program priority. Now, with respect to many past opportunities, did we have an opportunity to identify this? When we looked back far enough, back in the 1980s, before we set up a formal motor operated valve program, we did see some examples, of a broken limit switch due to improper setup. We had changed our setup. We had actually established setup criteria because back at that time, there was no criteria to coordinate that internal limit switch
okay.
with this external limit switch, resulting in some failures. By instituting those procedure changes, we got consistent performance up until this most recent event. At that point, we recognized we had missed some vendor instructions. Our people had not identified a concern or a question with respect to this. Had we recognized that, we would have acted upon it. So at some point, you have to say, I don't know what I don't know, but on the other hand, what we're doing as a result of this is evaluating, as I mentioned, in depth again, our motor operated valve program and the adequacy of how well we've picked up our vendor instructions with respect to these valves. We know we've done it very extensively for the torque switches and the internal rotor limit switches. This external limit switch, which is an unusual configuration compared to the rest of the industry, was a standout, so it got a different level of scrutiny that we're going back to revisit.
You know, I think it's quite interesting that I could ask this question and you were able to answer that you'd actually looked as far back as the 80s to try to find some example where something like this had happened before that you might have learned from. And you did that work to check and see whether you had some sort of repeated problem here or whether something, frankly, that was a surprise that hadn't been anticipated had occurred. And now you scrub things so that it won't ever happen again. And in that sense, I think that this is a good example of the proper approach to sustaining a high level of safety.
And Dr. Peterson, what I would add to that, too, is I think Tom did a good job of going over talking about the previous things back in the 80s. But as you're fully aware, too, and just for the benefit of the public, because the system is such a safety-significant system, and there can be things happen that could happen, such as improper setup of switches or maintenance. It's why we have those redundant mechanisms of being able to actuate the system, such as what's displayed there on the manual actuation of the valve with the hand wheel, or also being able to actuate it at the breaker cubicle. So we try to take into consideration all of those things to be able to make sure that we have alternate methodologies as well for safety-related equipment.
Right, I agree, and I think that another important characteristic of what was discovered here is the fact that it was a failure that occurred a fracture after repeated actuation, and those can be really tough things to identify until something happens. And that's the point where your ability to take, first of all, just the redundancy of the systems, because it's actually unlikely to happen. That type of failure is unlikely to happen simultaneously in multiple systems. So that's not something that you expect to see a common mode problem with. No. I think that's one interesting feature of this type of failure is that it's going to occur infrequently, and the key thing is that when you experience it, you figure out how to make sure that it won't ever happen again, right? And we've been watching. There's a company called SpaceX that people might have heard of. Mm-hmm. And the root cause analysis for this thing that happened on the launch pad is fascinating. The launch pad in Florida, where they had a cryogenic. I don't know if people follow this sort of stuff. It was a very similar thing. It was something that was going to reveal itself at some point. The architecture of the SpaceX. So the architecture of the SpaceX rocket system is much better from the perspective of a consequence compared to space shuttle. Mm-hmm. Really was a poor idea to have astronauts ride with cargo every single time you launch. That was a really, really strategically poor idea. And it caused real problems. very similar thing. This was going to reveal it. Sometime you fix it, and it won't ever happen again. And that's how you drive the system towards high levels of reliability. And the fortunate thing is the architecture, as with this case, allowed you to have that kind of failure occur so that you could discover it with minor consequence, right? And that's the key thing about the redundancy and diversity in the safety systems that are judged to be of significance here. So at any rate, I think that's enough philosophical discussion.
Well, yeah, I'm not going to talk philosophically. I want to get into some detail because I think it's worth the public's understanding. From the one outage to the next outage, as best we can tell, the train B of ECCS would not have allowed switchover from the tanks to recirculation if it was called on. That's what we learned. And what that means is that, you and we, none of us know whether it failed somewhere during that period, but we mostly think it probably was caused at the time because that's when humans were around it, but we don't know. So the assumption is it had been failed all that time or somewhere in between, but certainly when you went and looked, it was train B of ECCS would not have allowed switchover from the tanks to recirculation if you called upon. On the other hand, train A was fine when you looked, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the analysis that the NRC does and that you do too, in order to understand the significance of this, ask the question, if we had a Los Acuilan accident during that year and a half, meaning a break of a 5-inch line or a something or a tank or a pump seal that leaked at a certain rate, and we had to call upon ECCS, what's the probability that that other train wouldn't be there? Okay? Mm-hmm. So there's two pieces, and therefore you'd get the accident. Well, there are
right.
two pieces to this, and they're separate, but they're really important. The first is you can ask the question and you can try to answer it. If we had the 5-inch pipe break, and we were going down this path, we meaning the plant, and all of a sudden it was time to switch over from pumping from the storage tank to recirculation, and you found out that valve had failed.
Mm-hmm.
There are two questions to ask. One is, what is the likelihood that the staff, the operating crew, could recover that train B? And there are two means of recovery, which you just mentioned. One is you can run down to the valve and do something manual, and the other one is you can do something electrical downstairs in the control room that would then enable you to do it from there.
Mm-hmm.
And if either of those was successful, then you could recover train B.
Correct.
But train A is still sitting there, and it, if it works, is sufficient. So the second piece of the analysis is to ask the question, even though train A is, in retrospect, okay, not everything is perfect all the time. So you can do an analysis and ask the question, what is the probability a priori that when you called on train A, it wouldn't be there?
Mm-hmm.
For some other reason.
Right.
All right? You know, because, in fact, we know that not everything is perfect all the time. There are any number of reasons why that could be. And we have an analysis of that, we meaning the community. It's the sort of thing I do. And so the Nuclear Regulatory Commission went through both of those analyses, and they concluded that the probability that that train B could be recovered successfully in the time allowed, there was a certain time, was a certain probability.
Yes.
And then they also went through another analysis, and they concluded that the probability that train A would be unavailable, remember, and you couldn't recover train B, so was some other probability. And you can work those out together, and if both of those bad things happen, then you have the accident because you can't inject. After you ran out of the tank, you can't recirculate.
Right.
And those probabilities were worked out, and the NRC originally concluded that the probability that you'd get a core damage accident during that period from those two things happening, now that we know that the original failure was there, was several 10 to the minus 6 per year.
Correct.
Which is several parts in a million per year, but it's several 10 to the minus 6 per year. The staff, meaning your colleagues here in the station, who are PRA experts themselves, did a different analysis. They did the same analysis. But they concluded that the NRC had made some assumptions about the configuration that weren't that didn't jive with what was actually out here, and they did a different analysis, and they concluded that the probability was actually much lower. It was more several 10 to the minus 7 instead of several 10 to the minus 6 per year, which is about a factor of 10 different. These are all very low probabilities, but nevertheless, there was a difference. And then there was this public meeting that I listened in, and so did Furman Wardell remotely, and people from the public could listen, and there was back and forth, and then the NRC revised their analysis, and they agreed that some of PG&E's assumptions were reasonable and some they didn't agree with, and they came out with something in between. But here's the crucial point for the public, okay? All of those numbers are really low. That is, the probability of getting a core damage accident because of the following sequence of events, that you couldn't recover train B, and that train A would have suffered some other failure, so that when you called on it, it wasn't there for some other reason, based on, we have data about that from around the world. They did that analysis, and they concluded it was a very low number, and then PG&E said it was lower still, and then they came back in between. All those numbers are really low. And mm-hmm. I'm not sure that the significance of the differences between those numbers is important. And the reason is because we have so much uncertainty about some of those analyses that it's really hard to know whether or not the probability of recovery of that valve is 32% or 39%. I mean, that's sort of hocus pocus, even though you do put numbers on them. But there's a lot of uncertainty in those numbers. But it's a crucial point to understand. The fact that, in retrospect, that train A was seen to be okay is not the same as saying that the plant was perfectly safe during that time, because we know there is some probability that it might not have been, even though that probability didn't materialize. Why? Because the world is, some other things happen, you know, junk happens. Mm-hmm. That probability is real low, but it's not zero. Okay? And it is therefore never the case that the plant is perfectly safe. We know that the probability of getting in trouble is around 10 minus 5 or 10 minus 6 per year altogether, and this is a small fraction of that, but it's a piece of it. And then there's a second thing which is really important, and this is really quite different. The NRC asked itself the question that even though train A was okay, what's the probability that it might have happened on train B? The same thing, not something different, but the same thing.
Right.
It didn't happen. But there is some small probability that, we'll pretend a maintenance person had done that, they made the same error. Mm-hmm. And they struggled with trying to work out, and that's called the common cause failure. That is, the thing that caused train B to fail didn't happen at train A, we know, but it might. Mm-hmm. What's the probability of that? It's not 100%, but it sure isn't zero either. So they struggled with some understanding of what, based on, we have a lot of experience in the industry, in which a maintenance person makes the same error here and here. It doesn't happen often, but it happens from time to time, and we have some data about that. We meaning the community, and that's the work I do. And so they tried to assign some numerical probability to the likelihood that the common cause might have disabled train A, even though when we looked it hadn't. And by the way, everybody's glad that when we looked it hadn't, because it would have been there. But, mm-hmm. but nevertheless, you know, it might have. And they thought that was some low, but finite probability, several percent, and they assigned that number to it, and that was part of the analysis that they came up with. It ended up that they thought it was too high, altogether too high, and they called it white rather than, if it had been a little lower, it would have been green. But I want to make two points. The first is, we in this community do these analyses because we're looking for the numbers, because the numbers teach us something. But the numbers aren't the main thing. The main thing is, by doing that analysis, we can identify some place where something is out there that nobody had thought of, or, if you don't mind my saying, mm-hmm. or had thought was different than, or, gee, we wish we had done more, or, golly, we wish we had done more maintenance.
Yes.
And that's the insight. It isn't those numbers, although it's comforting to see the numbers were small. Because, and this is the main lesson for me, you can always do more. It's impossible not to think you can do more. I'm going to give you my example. Okay, I gave it last night. I've got a car sitting at Oakland Airport, and the left rear tire is leaking a little bit. The normal pressure was down by 3 pounds. And so on the way to the airport, I put a little in, and when I get home, I'm going to fix the tire. Now, that can happen to any car that any of us own anywhere. You know how you really get on top of that? Every single time you go out to your car, you take a gauge and you measure all four tires.
or buy a Cadillac, indication.
Hang on.
Cadillac indicated tire pressure.
But you better bring a gauge calibration device, too, to make sure that your gauge is calibrated compared to yesterday. You could do that. And you know what? Your car would have a lower probability of trouble. But we don't do that. Why? We've decided, the world has decided, that that amount of intervention isn't a necessary or even desirable expense compared to its loss. That's what you do in nuclear power plants. You decide that a certain maintenance interval is sufficient because we have experience that tells us that it's sufficient. And from time to time, that sufficiency is challenged by an observation.
Bob, you need to get a new car. The new ones have tire pressure monitoring.
Well, I'm not exactly right. I told you it's an old car. I guess what I'm saying is the lesson here is that for you and for the public, everything we do has certain maintenance intervals and certain checks that we do and certain calibrations that we do, but we don't do them every single time we get into the car because we think that's not necessary. But from time to time, we learn something like you've just learned that you wished you had known because now you're going to do something different on that particular thing and maybe a few others. But you can't ever say, gee, I wished I had known that in advance because the judgment you made has actually been borne out for 30 years, and it's more than that. It's been borne out by 30 years in 100 stations. And what happened? You got bit. But fortunately for all of us, you got bit with something that's really, really... thankfully, small this time. Okay?
So let's thank Dr. Butness for an education on risk assessment.
Yeah, that's the whole point of what we're doing here.
And let's open the forum up for public comments. On Mr. Bowen, are you done with your presentation?
I am. To Dr. Budnitz's point, I would like to say we did get some insights as a result of this event, even though they're very low risk significant. We've made changes
and we're following
to our quarterly valve stroke tests, such that we are now observing the switch locally to verify its travel, and I mentioned that earlier, but we're also then checking the interlock circuit. As I mentioned, it doesn't have an indication of whether the circuit makes up or not. We're part of that quarterly test now going and checking, does the circuit energize when the valve strokes?
So that's a good thing. Good for you.
Yes.
So Dr. Bender should set up a tutorial on risk assessment online. It'd be
site. But the crucial lesson for the public is that because you find something like this from time to time, doesn't mean that you've invalidated all the experience we bring to bear on the things that we do. It's just from time to time you get bit. And we always hope that it's going to be something small, not something important.
Let us now entertain public comments on Mr. Ballman's presentation on the white finding. Please come to the podium and identify yourself.
Sherry Lewis, San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace. I do not have a question on his work, but on a couple of things that Dr. Budnitz said. You mentioned that this, train A, train B, either one of them is all that's necessary, but the other is a backup. And you said, you mentioned something about around the world, and that struck me to ask, has it ever happened somewhere around the world that both trains have been not usable?
No.
It hasn't. Okay. The other question I have is...
No. I mean, I unless somebody can correct me, I believe no.
Okay.
And if it hadn't, I think we would have known.
Is you talk about 10 to the minus 5, 10 to the minus 6 per year problem. Mm-hmm. And what numbers would worry you? 10 to the minus what would worry you?
Well, this worries me in the sense that we miss something, we the community miss something that we'd like to know. So this is not something that's not a worry. It's not a huge worry, but it's something that's not that you would worry about, okay?
But as far as numbers go, anyway, when...
Say that again?
I guess it depends on what we're talking about, then. I mean, 10 to the minus 5, 10 to the minus 6 seems like a very small probability.
When is it less small?
I can give you the NRC's answer. The NRC worries... If the contingent probability of getting in trouble per year gets up around 10 minus 4 per year, which is a factor 10 minus 4 per year, which is a factor of almost 100 more than what they found here, 100 more, they really get concerned. They're going to give you a red finding, and then you're going to really correctly be jumping in to do something that's urgent. Okay?
Okay.
Now, that's their answer. My personal answer is I don't know what's real bad, although yet you'll know when you see it, but this is something that we wished wasn't there and that they're appropriately fixing.
Okay, and the final thing is about your car.
About my car.
The car situation.
It's sitting out in Oakland.
Don't forget that a car is – problems with a car is one thing. Problems with this brand-new science, which is a generation old only –
I know.
Is so much greater. And, of course, I claim, being old, I claim that we got along fine before nuclear power. Nuclear power has a possibility of being so devastating we shouldn't even be using it.
Oh, I understand.
That's my feeling.
By the way, my great-grandparents got along fine without electricity.
Yes.
Except, you know what? They didn't get along fine.
Really?
No.
It's tough without electricity. But just a little bit more on the qualitative and quantitative risk goals that result in this number of 10 to the minus 4. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission at the highest level has established the goal that for people who live in the vicinity of a nuclear plant, the incremental risk from living in the area compared to all of the risks that you face should be about 1 in 1,000 or less. And so, therefore, if there's an accident at the plant, your risk of being killed because of radioactive release from that accident is expected to be less than 1 out of 1,000 of your risk that you could die in all other types of accidents that occur. And actual risks generally end up being a bit lower than that. Going back to my analogy with my employment risk, so I pointed out I work in a 5-story building on the Berkeley campus that is built to 1960s code, in which we know that the construction didn't fully meet code because when we did some chipping on concrete and stuff, we found debris in between layers where they'd poured concrete. There's nothing we can do about it.
Sure.
So... No, well, we could not with the budgets that we devote to fixing seismic problems for infrastructure besides some limited kinds. So my personal risk calculation goes like this. In the next 20 years that I'm likely to be working in that building about 8 hours a day, so let's say about a third of my time, in that 20 years, there's now, I think it's a 70% chance that we'll have the earthquake. So roughly speaking, I've got maybe a 20 to 25% chance that I will be in that building when the Hayward Fault goes. Okay? Now, let's just give it a pretty rough estimate that there's a 90% chance that that building will have good life safety. And work out the numbers and then ask whether you would accept those statistics for any kind of job because they're significantly worse than the risks of working in a coal mine, right? And then, you know, we've got this wonderful thing that we did to manage risk on the Berkeley campus, which is we have this building called Tolman Hall, which is even worse than Echeverry. And about 8 years ago, we finally concluded that it was from a risk perspective, unacceptable
to
hold general assignment classes in that building because of the risk to life safety, the residual risk of life safety. So we stopped that. We had no money to build any replacement, so we've been struggling to try to get classes to fit on the campus ever since. But when you work through the math, it's still okay to have the Graduate School of Education and all of their staff work in that building. And they have been. Now, talk about feeling valued by your employer, right? I mean, this is. I'm not lying about this. The PG&E is actually pretty good to its employees compared to the state of California. So finally, what the campus has done is we've taken out a big loan, and we're in the process of constructing because there's no state money to do anything
to address this kind of situation. We're building a large replacement building, and we built into that big loan that we're taking out enough funding so that we can tear down Tolman Hall. And then it'll be gone, and we will have taken care of it, and we will be paying debt on that loan because, again, we're not getting enough money to fix the problem. Okay. So placed into perspective, what we're doing here is actually pretty good if we're getting to 10 to the minus 3, at least compared to some of the other things that we do in the state. And then I'll get off that soapbox. Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Dr. Peterson. Additional public comments on Mr. Baldwin's presentation? Hearing none, this is a good time to take a break for 10 minutes. Hang Please on. Come Hang back.
I have a 10-second comment. I'm in his building about an hour a week. I mean, you're there all the time. I have to rethink whether when I go to something there, I want to go outside.
Should we pass a hat around to collect donations for Berkeley?
Please.
Okay, let's take a break for 10 minutes.
You know what I'm doing there.
Ladies and gentlemen, please take your seat. Let us reconvene. Are we ready, Mr. Audio and Video? Okay, thank you, thank you. Thank you. Mr. Kerry Harbour, are you ready to resume your presentation, please? Mr. Harbour?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, we're all set and ready to resume. Our next presentation is going to be an update on our NRC performance indicators, and it will be performed by our Manager of Regulatory Services, Hussein Hamzahi. And Hussein has well over 30 years of experience in the nuclear industry, a significant amount of that with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission in various roles and in leadership positions. He has a bachelor's degree in mechanical engineering as well as a master's degree in nuclear engineering. And with that, I'll hand it over to Hussein.
Thank you, Kerry. Good morning,
Welcome.
Everyone.
Good morning.
Thank you. It's good to be here again. Seems like yesterday, but it's been over 3 months. Next page. Before I start talking about the status of our performance based on the NRC performance indicators, I'd like to reiterate again that Diablo Canyon is rigorously inspected by the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and we are committed to the highest standard of safety, and we constantly reevaluate our operations and emergency plans and take immediate actions to make sure that we are always ready to meet our mission of protecting public health and safety. Next page, please. Now, in summary, this last time we talked was in October, so this performance period is for 3 months, from November through the end of January, and in the last 3 months, we had about roughly 3,000 of NRC inspection hours, and during this performance period, we met the green performance expectations for all the NRC performance indicators, and I will quickly go over those as you have seen them in the past. And again, during this performance period, we had received 3 very low safety significant violations from the NRC, and also 1 white finding that Tom Baldwin spent enough time to tell you about it, so I'm not going to talk much about it, but I just want to mention that was one of the findings that we got with the white, which is, again, low to moderate safety.
Now, Mr. Hamzahi.
Yes, sir.
May I comment that the white finding by the NRC has consequences?
Yes.
It put this facility into
yes.
column 2
Correct.
Of the action matrix?
Yes, we have under reactor oversight process, for those that are not familiar, we have ROP action matrix under the reactor oversight process. And that action matrix has 4 columns, almost 5 columns. It goes from 1 all the way to 5. And column 1 is the least risk significant. That is, everything is in green or lower performance threshold, and it's in the licensee's response column. And once you get one or more greater than green, which is white, then you get to the second column, which is the regulator's response. So still, it's low to moderate response column. And what that means is that now the NRC is going to look more, and they may do some supplemental inspections to make sure that this white finding has been corrected, the adequate root cause evaluations have been done, the corrective actions have been identified, extent of condition, extent of cause, and similar failures would not happen again.
Right. Do you have a plan to move this facility from column 2 into column 1?
We already...
So, on what time schedule?
Yes. So, most likely, we are going to move back to column 1 at the end of the second quarter of this year, which means July 1st. Unless, which is very, very unlikely, we get another non-green violation. But if this is the only one, by the end of second quarter, we'll move back to column 1.
Does the agency move that fast? By which I mean the NRC? Do they?
Yes, there are some timeline metrics that if they issue a white finding, they have to, within that 1 year, they have to complete their supplemental inspection. And if there are no other concerns or white findings, then they're going to move their licensee back to the lower column.
So this is very aggressive. If you're
yes.
thinking about July of 2017.
Correct.
That's a very aggressive schedule.
Well, yes and no. It's, you know, it's 1 year, so that should be feasible, yeah. And not to mention that Diablo Canyon is ready. We have already completed all of our evaluations. We, you know, so it's, if the NRC was ready tomorrow, we could demonstrate that we are ready to move back to column one. But by definition, you have to wait for 12 months before, from the time you get the white finding till you can get back to column, lower column.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. So next, please. These are a summary of the NRC performance indicators that we, with other licensees, follow and monitor on a daily basis. And you have seen these. There are about 16 performance indicators. I'm not going to go through all of them, but I just like to name a few. As you see on the top, one of the performance indicators is how many unplanned scrams or reactor trips have you had in 7,000 critical hours, or how many reactor trips you've had with complications. They go all the way down to how you perform your emergency response organizations and how you do your alert and notifications. So there are about 16 of them, and as you see from this slide, units 1 and 2 both were in the green region for the last 3 months. Next, please. We also provide you with a summary of our licensee event reports during the performance period. In the last few months, we have not had any LERs, so there's nothing to report. Next, please. And again, since we always talk about colors and every NRC findings or violation has an assigned color to it, so it's always good to go back and refresh our memory as to what these colors mean. As you know, the violations or findings are anywhere from green all the way to red. So green means it's a very low safety significance. The next higher is white, which is still low to moderate. And the yellow is substantial, and red is high safety significance. And you, again, we don't want to talk about numbers, but each color also has some number associated with it, which is related to the core damage frequency numbers. And just for your information, red, for instance, is the one that has a CDF, or core damage frequency, of greater than 1 times 10 to the minus 4.
Yeah, that's what I saw.
Next, please. So as we discussed a few minutes ago, we got 3 violations during this performance period. The first one was a non-cited severity level 4 violation, and that was related to the completeness and accuracy of license operator exam. And let me just explain to you, because that's really not, it's a very minor finding. And what happened is, when we are getting ready to provide examination for our operating license applicants, we provide the examination prior to conducting the exam to the NRC, and they review it and they make sure it meets their criteria. And once they're done, then they'll okay it and we'll perform the examination. Last year, they did review it and they didn't have any questions except one question, I believe it was question 55 or 56, that had two right answers, plausible right answers. So NRC mentioned that maybe we should somehow adjust it so that it only has one right answer. So we corrected it, and they approved it, and we provided that to our applicants. And after the exam was completed, we identified by reviewing that examination that mistakenly that question was replaced by the old one, which still had two right answers. So we did it. Extend up condition evaluations. We didn't have any other questions with that scenario, and we identified it, and we quickly told the NRC, but because that happened, they gave us a violation of severity level 4, which level 4 is like green.
Isn't it kind of interesting, actually, to challenge people with a problem where there's actually two correct ways or two correct answers?
If you ask me, I would say yes, but if you ask the applicants, they say no. They like to just have one answer.
I mean, if somebody was absolutely perfect, they'd still have only a 50% chance of being perfect.
That's
no, I mean,
I. Well, you're right.
That doesn't sound right. Huh?
In the real you're world, right. Most commonly, there's more than one way skin the cat.
You're right, yeah.
So there can be multiple correct answers to most questions.
That's correct.
Yeah, but your challenge is to write a test where there's only one. What do you think?
Well, at any rate, I do find it
interesting, right.
That this is considered to be a problem. This is a bug, not a feature.
Right? Yeah. So it's pretty minor, but again, we follow our regulations, and as soon as we identified it, we informed them, and this is a violation. And again, because of that and no impact on safety, they gave us the lowest significance level, which is level 4. And then the second was again, a green non-cited violation, and I hope everyone understands by now what non-cited violation means. That was related to our fire protection suppression system. And let me just talk a little more about it so that you also understand why this is very insignificant and why they assign green to it. We had our triannual fire inspection last year, and as they were going through the inspection, we again identified when we test the system, there are also some subsystems of the same system that not as important the main system. So what we do is we do flow test and pressure test. So we realized that for a small portion of a system, we did not do the pressure test as required by the fire protection standards. And however, we did do the flow test, and we demonstrated that it passed at over 50% of the required flow. But since we were not consistent with the NFPA fire standards, we quickly identified it. We informed our inspectors that were on site, and we went back and put it into our corrective action program, quickly did a pressure test, and resolved the problem. So when we provided that to the NRC and identified it, since it had no impact on other systems and this was already flow tested, so this was mainly compliance, they gave us the lowest color, which is green. Next. And the next violation was, this one was identified by one of our resident inspectors, And if you see there, we have in some of our high energy systems like main steam, we have rupture restraint. And most of you know that they are restrained to make sure that if we have pipe rupture and there's some movement, they don't impact adjacent safety-related components. So on this one, our resident inspector, as he was doing his walk down, he realized that that rupture restraint was not tight and there were some loose bolts. So he brought it to our attention, we fixed it. So then when we fixed it, we did not follow the procedures that were supposed to be followed when you put something, you know. So we quickly fixed it, but we were not following the documented procedure for fixing it, and we got a minor violation in that area. But again, it had no impact on any other systems, and it's the lowest safety significance.
Question.
Yes, sir.
So did you look into why the plant staff did not identify that? And
I believe so, yes. But remember, sometimes it's, you know, you, unless you do a detailed walkdown of that specific one, when you do a visual inspection, sometimes it's visible, sometimes it's not. But I remember that they did put the team together, went back and looked at it, and they have put it into their corrective actions, and it's now in the program to do a more detailed inspection of those restraints. But
there's two possibilities at least, but one of them is that it, in the insulation or checking, somebody didn't tighten it or something. The second is it, quote, came loose.
Yes.
That happens too. Do you know which of those it was? Yeah.
I'm not sure. I can get back to you.
It's okay. I just was curious. Yeah. Obviously, somebody, I assume, got to the bottom of that.
Correct. Oh, yeah. As I mentioned, okay. We immediately entered it into our corrective action program and looked at it, fixed it, yes.
So in the corrective action program, they would have asked just the question I just asked.
Correct, okay. Yes. Next, please. So, and last but not least is the white finding that we got with respect to our 8700 alpha valve, and I believe you've had enough discussions on that, so I'm not going to offer any more information on it.
Have one more question on
that. Yes, sir.
If you would, please, could you kind of just briefly explain how you get from column 2 back to column 1?
Yes.
What actions you have to take in the 95001
yes.
process?
Well, there are two conditions. The first condition is, given that you don't get any additional white finding, so because if you get, then you stay in that column. So if you don't get any additional, regardless of how quickly you fix the problem, the NRC requirements are that you stay in that column for at least 12 months. So, but now, in order for them to make sure that you're now okay to move back to column 1, what happens is if you get greater than green finding, then they're going to issue you a notice of violation. It's a formal notice of violation that they did issue to Diablo Canyon in December of last year. And as soon as you get a formal notice of violation, the licensee is required to respond in writing. And then you enter into, we call it 95001 or 95001 supplemental inspection. That means if you get one finding, then there are some requirements that you have to do a detailed root cause evaluation and then extent of condition, extent of cause, and provide some corrective actions that would prevent you from having the similar failures. And once you do that and you're ready, then you inform the NRC staff for us in Region 4 that you're ready for their supplemental inspection. So then they send a team to your site, they inspect that, they review your corrective actions and your root cause, and if they have adequate information to ensure that this failure has been analyzed and won't happen again for the same causes, then they're going to complete an inspection and write their report that we're ready and the problem has been resolved. Then at the end of the year, 12 months, then they're going to write you a letter to say that you're now in column 1. So this is the process.
Okay, thank you. Do you have a timetable for when you'll be ready and when they'll inspect?
Yes, we I'm glad you're asking. We were actually going over our action plan. We're almost done with all of our root cause evaluation, so I would say we should be ready in the next month or so to inform the NRC that they can come in and perform their 95001 inspection.
Thanks.
Because there is really nothing more for us to do other than just going back and looking at the documentation and making sure we're ready. Any other questions? All right, next. So this is basically all my presentation. Now, at the end, in summary, I'd like to reemphasize that Diablo Canyon performance during this performance period was green based on the NRC performance indicators. And I also like to quickly provide a summary of all the inspection reports that have been provided. Almost all of you have access to these reports. We've had reports starting from like October of last year on security inspection report, third quarter integrated inspection report, which is the resident inspector's report that they prepare every quarter at the end of the quarter. And then the last one is, again, security, and also the one before last is the inspection report that they issued that they determined the final categorization of that white finding. And that concludes my presentation.
Thank you.
I have one quick question. Is there any – I'm not going to put you on the spot because maybe you don't have the list with you. Is there any important NRC inspections coming up in the next few months before
yes.
our next public
yes.
meeting that you can just touch on?
Yes. We're going to have fitness for duty inspection
okay.
that's going to happen in a couple of weeks. We are going to have we have a few more. I think the first one is the fitness for duty. Mm. And we have this year, last year was a very heavy inspection year because, as you remember, we have annual, biannual, triannual, and last year a lot of those triannuals happened to be in the same year, so we had many of them. This year are mainly the annual traditional inspections that are going to happen, in addition to the 95001. So, and I have a table, if you like. I usually, at the beginning of the year, after the NRC kind of finalizes the list, we put together a list of all the inspections and provide it to everyone. So if you would like, I can share it
right,
with you.
So what you should do is provide it to Brian. That's how we get it.
Yes.
And in fact, that year-long
that summary,
thing might be something that we could imagine just making available on our website. Public can see it. It's nothing.
Sure, and I work with Brian.
Yes. About that. If you can do that, that would just
yes.
help us.
Yeah, I'll do that.
I mean, we go around the plant, so we learn about a lot of these, but there might be some that have escaped our attention.
Yes, and the other inspection we had a couple of weeks ago was on open face condition.
Oh, yes, yeah, I know about that.
So we had that inspection, and what
right.
they do is they have a TI 192, because
right.
the headquarters is still trying to finalize that open phase issue. So what they have is they came up with this temporary instruction for all the licenses in the country. And what they do is from now till you implement your final design to address open phase condition, you have most of the licenses have defined some comp measure or compensatory measures that they are in place till they do a permanent design mod. So they came to our site to make sure those compensatory measures have been implemented correctly.
Thank
so,
you.
And they didn't have any findings. I think they had maybe a few observations. Yes.
And another one that might be coming up is it's in early April that the one-year clock runs out on the NFP 805
yes.
implementation. There's a certain date, and then suddenly it becomes...
Now, what happens is... Fire protection inspection usually is triannual,
yeah.
so every 3 years. And ours happened last year. But you're correct. We transitioned from Appendix Romeo to NFPA 805 starting last year. But once you NRC approves your amendment request to become a NFPA 805 plan, then you have 1 year to be in full compliance.
So then
and that's called transition period.
Yeah,
so right now we're in that transition period.
But that runs out in early April. So that's
correct.
Right. So I imagine there's a possibility they might want to come out. You'll see.
They may want to do just for NFPA 805, or they may choose to wait till the next fire protection inspection.
Which is a year later.
which is another 2 years from now.
Do you anticipate, after the NFP AO5 implementation, the number of notices on fire protection safety would be dramatically different than what's been happening in the past? I mean, I say anticipation.
Well, it's my opinion. So I'm just going to share my opinion with you
please.
At this point. Because once you transition from Appendix Romeo, which is the traditional fire protection requirements, to a risk-informed performance-based program, which is NFPA 805, and the program and regulations are so new, so it's going to be a learning curve for the industry as well as for the NRC. So I'm guessing, my opinion is that in the next 4 or 5 years, there may be some learning and some findings because licensees and NRC are still trying to figure out what these things mean and how they should be implemented. So I'm assuming that maybe the next inspection we may get some because we're not 100% sure what the requirement was supposed to do, or they may come back. Because there are a lot of complex requirements under NFPA 805, but the advantage is NFPA 805 is risk-informed, performance-based. So you're really spending all your time and effort in those areas that are really risk-significant to fire risk. Whereas in the Appendix Romeo, you just have to follow a lot of prescriptive requirements without really focusing on what is the most important fire risk initiator. So this is going to definitely improve the overall fire risk, but the inspection part, we are working with NRC to better understand and learn the implementation aspect of it. And we have already made some safety design mods. There are a few more that we're planning to make as part of the NFPA 805. So I strongly believe that our fire risk is really going to be improved and reduced significantly.
If you send that list to Brian for us, and again, we'll make it available, that may help us. For example, we have fact-finding topics that we go through during the year, and we may want to think about arranging our schedule so as to review them when they, you know, time. And
yes.
It's obvious, just in a timely way. Thanks.
That would be a good topic, actually.
Thank
You're
you.
Right. Yes, sure. My pleasure. Anything else?
Yeah.
Thank you. Right. Thanks for the opportunity.
Let's welcome public comments on our speaker's presentation. There being none, Mr. Harper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Having a little trouble here with my microphone, but that's okay.
Thank you.
The next speaker that we have is the last speaker for the morning session, and the topic is our Unit 1 20th refueling outage, an overview of what's ahead for us, and that presentation will be done by our outage manager, Matt Cowart. And Matt has been in the industry for well over 25 years with nuclear experience, has a Bachelor of Science degree in mechanical engineering, and has held leadership roles in operations as well as engineering along with the outage and work control functions.
Great. Thank you, Kerry. Good morning.
Welcome.
Welcome. Next slide. Okay, so 1R20 begins April 23rd, and this morning I hope you give you a good idea of what the scope of the work involved in the refueling outage, as well as big picture kind of what the schedule and how we built the schedule. Next slide. Okay, major scope, the permanent cavity seal. So this is a permanent cavity seal that is used to seal up the annular space between the reactor.
Yes. Can I stop?
Certainly.
Will you tell the public the dates of the outage?
The start date.
Start and end.
The start date is April 23rd. The end date is we're still working on the schedule, so I can't give you a firm end date. It will be significantly longer than our previous outages, which typically ran 33 days, because of the larger scope of work.
Okay.
Okay?
Yeah, just people ought to know it, you know, that it's coming up.
Yeah, April 23rd. So the permanent cavity seal, what the cavity seal is used for is to seal up the annular space between the reactor vessel flange and the refueling cavity floor. So this is actually equipment reliability improvement. Effectively, our vendor will be welding in a plate that has gaps and then O-ring seals to close those gaps. And then at the end of the outage, you take those covers off to allow ventilation to come up around the reactor during normal operation.
What's the current design?
The current design is a temporary cavity seal that we install. It's rubber and held down by J-bolts.
Oh, so then this just remains in place, but you move it so that it's open? Is that
it? Yeah. Basically, if you picture a big donut, yeah, and then you take four bites out of the donut, those are covers that we can install and remove. So when we want to put water in the cavity, we install the covers. And then during normal operation, you need ventilation up around the reactor vessel. So you remove the covers at the end of the outage so that you restore your normal ventilation up past the reactor vessel.
And this new design just stays in place? So you just, or it's, I'm still not quite catching how it's different.
Yeah. So again, it's a stainless steel circle, mm-hmm, and that stays in place the whole time. And then when we want to put water in the cavity, there's holes in the cover to allow ventilation during normal operation. When we want to flood the cavity, then we install covers that have O-rings.
You plug the holes.
That's correct.
Okay, which is simpler. Okay.
Yeah.
I just that sounds like an improvement.
Yeah. It's easier with pictures. So.
Now may I ask what precipitated this replacement? What happened to the old design?
So the old design, we've had instances in previous outages where we have leakage by the cavity seal. Mm-hmm. Now it's fairly low-level leakage, so it's not a danger to draining the cavity, but it does get boric acid and potentially damage components that are located under the not under the reactor vessel, but under where the cavity seal seals up. Does that make sense?
Okay. Okay, thanks.
The next, and probably the most significant scope of work is baffle former bolt inspection and replacement. So I don't know, have they received a baffle former bolt? Because I'm not an expert. There's 800.
Let's pretend that we might have, but we're talking to the public.
Okay. So baffle former bolts, there's 832. They are installed in the lower internals. And so the scope of work is we will ultrasonically examine all 832, and then any bolts that we see indications on the ultrasonic test will be replaced.
How big are these? Are they like this big?
They're 5/8. They're 5/8 diameter, and they're about this long.
Got it. Okay.
Okay. Some of them are longer. Some of them are shorter, depending on the location in the core barrel. Okay. Containment fan cooler unit 1/5.
Before you go further. Now on the baffle bolt, when the reactor vessel was designed, my recollection tells me this bolt replacement is not necessary, right? The reactor vessel should last
years. Yeah, the inspection has been driven by operating experience at other nuclear power plants where they have found defects in some of the bolts, and it has to do with the specific design, certain types of Westinghouse. Not all Westinghouse reactor internals are the same. So based on some OEs from other power plants that have the same design as Unit 1 is what causes us to go inspect and see the condition of our bolts. Yeah. Unit 2 has a different design in terms of how the flow goes through the core, so we will not be doing this on the Unit 2 outage.
Right. So the initial design criteria was for 40 years, right?
That's correct.
Right. Sure.
Yeah. This is a surprise.
Okay, so containment fan cooler unit, as a reminder, each unit has 5 containment fan cooler units in the containment, and that they're designed to reduce the pressure if we have a steam line break or a reactor coolant break. We are cutting out the old ones and replacing them with new stainless steel cooling coils. Rod control cluster guide card inspections. This is the same. Yes.
On the containment fan cooler coil replacement, I was thinking we heard yesterday on the capital projects that this might not be done or wouldn't be done.
No, fan cooler 1/5 is most definitely in scope. We already have the replacement coils are already on site. We have a welding mm-hmm. contract signed, so it's definitely in scope for 1R20.
Yeah, looking ahead at other fan coolers that would have similar type of scope. Those are still under review. The final decision has not been made on those.
Okay, good. Thanks.
Okay. Rod control cluster guide card inspections. This is the same scope of work that we performed in 2R19. We're doing it on Unit 1 now. Reactor vessel cold leg nozzle inspections. We every 10 years, we're required to ultrasonically examine where the cold legs are welded to the reactor vessel. So we've done this before. The Bravo low-pressure turbine inspection, this is part of when we installed three brand-new low-pressure turbines. They have a certain amount of run hours, at which time you have to remove it and you do non-destructive examination of the low-pressure turbine. We're also doing a high-pressure turbine inspection. We haven't done one of those in quite some time. The high-pressure turbines, despite you'd think they'd be bigger than the low pressures, but they're actually smaller. Reactor coolant pump 1-4 motor overhaul. This is part of our 10-year PMs. So every outage, we're doing another reactor coolant pump. So this, I believe, is the fourth outage that we've done a reactor coolant pump motor overhaul. 230 kV switch 211-1 overhaul. The 211-1 switch is what operations uses to disconnect 230 kV to Unit 1. And so this is part of our ongoing electrical reliability improvement program. And so we're effectively replacing all the parts. And 480-volt Vital Bus Foxtrot breaker replacements. Again, this is part of our electrical reliability, and we're replacing breakers according to which bus is going to be cleared that outage. So like the previous outage was a hotel outage, and we did hotel breakers. Now 1R20 is a Foxtrot outage. Next slide. Okay. This outage is fairly unique in terms of the critical path. So just as a refresher, your standard critical path is you cool down, depressurize, drain to the flange, disassemble the reactor, flood the cavity, unload the core, and then at the back end, you reload the core, reassemble the reactor, and start the unit up. So the first critical path activity is the permanent cavity seal installation. And the reason that is on a critical path is we don't want to drain to the flange, which involves some risk, until we're ready to disassemble the reactor. And we don't have enough floor space to try to disassemble the reactor and install the permanent cavity seal. So we're going to be sitting in mode 5 loops filled, which as an ex-operator is a very comfortable place because I have redundant ways to remove decay heat. We're going to stay there until the cavity seal is installed, and then our maintenance department has mobilized, and once they're ready to start detention in the reactor, then we will lower RCS level to the flange. So effectively, this displaces your classic outage by about a week. Normally, we'd be disassembling the reactor day 3. Now we're doing it day 9 or 10. Then we will do. Then we get back to traditional outage with reactor disassembly and the core offload. Then we go into baffle formal bolt inspections. So the plan this time, Westinghouse is the vendor. They are bringing in two submarines that basically swim up to the baffle bolt, make contact with the ultrasonic transducer, and with two of them, we can do it faster. After we inspect the bolts, and Westinghouse will provide the analysis and the recommendations to replace, if any, which bolts to replace.
Why don't you, in parallel with the inspection, initiate replacement of bolts?
Okay. I'll get to that when we talk the next one. So bolt replacement machine mobilization. So to get an idea of what the machine is, the first thing you install is an indexing plate. And the indexing plate is a very tight fit with the baffle plates. It's designed to sit on the core plate. And then you install a 70-foot I-beam, which is where the tooling head will move up and down to machine. So it's basically a real estate thing. I can't have the sub swimming while I'm trying to install the baffle bolt replacement machine.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. Then baffle bolt replacement. Now, I'm not an expert, but talking to the experts, there's a minimum of four machining activities to replace a bolt. So the first one is you have to machine off what's known as a locking bar, and then you have to take out the old bolt, and then you have to put in the new bolt, and then you got to tighten it, and you have to crimp it. So we do have contingency plans such that if we can't get the old bolt out for whatever reason, we have contingency plans to actually machine it out and go to a 3/4-inch bolt. And this is all covered. Westinghouse has already provided the design, and engineering has accepted the design. So if we do have to execute that contingency, we're ready to do it.
How many bolts in total?
We don't know how many bolts in total.
No, I mean just total.
832.
So you inspect 832 bolts.
That's correct.
Okay.
We don't anticipate needing to replace 800 bolts. So, and
what's been the experience with other units in terms of the number that ended up needing to be replaced?
It depends. The one I know off the top of my head was DC Cook, and that was 174 bolts. So,
but they have been in the range of about 200. So give or take 10 or so.
Yeah, so for planning purposes, the contract and the materials and the schedule reflect a plan to replace 200 bolts.
How long does it take to replace one bolt?
Well, it depends. Again, it's complicated. The since it's a four-step process, the most efficient way is you do step one on a series of bolts that you can reach with the bolt replacement machine, and then you do it. Now, if you're having to move the bolt replacement machine around on the indexing plate, it slows it down. Our assumption is 8 bolts per day.
8?
Yes. That's per day, not shift. Then bolt replacement machine demobilization. So that is actually going to take longer than mobilization, and the driving force behind that is we do a detailed inspection to make sure we're not leaving any foreign material on that base plate. Because we are machining metal, and we're physically removing metal. Now, we do have vacuum systems designed to catch it, but we do a detailed foreign object search and retrieval before we pull the indexing plate, and then we do another foreign object search and retrieval on the actual core plate. So We look for shavings or anything that might have fallen, and then we pull the base plate, and then we look again to make sure we didn't.
Can stuff fall through the baffle plate down to the bottom of the vessel?
Potentially. Depending on the machine activity, it could go down the outside of the baffles and miss the indexing plate. So as part of our foreign material exclusion plan, we're actually draping. We have weighted drapes that are going over the hot legs, so no little shavings can actually like float into the hot leg because we're putting drapes over it.
Okay.
Yeah. Foreign material exclusion, we're taking it extremely seriously, and it's a big part of our plan. Then we get back to a traditional outage with the core reload, reactor reassembly, and plant startup. Yes.
With your core offload and then reload, are you doing anything special for your refueling equipment to be sure it's reliable and working well?
Yeah. Coming out just prior to last outage, we filled a position of a refueling program manager. We've put together a rapid response team. We're going through detailed work package review for pre-outage work on the spent fuel pool. And we're also doing detailed work package review for contingency planning on the manipulator and containment.
Okay. Okay. Sounds good.
Next slide. Okay, first-time evolutions. Everybody's always interested in first-time evolutions. Permanent cavity seal. Now, it's a first-time evolution here. However, the vendor Westinghouse has done it at other facilities. As mentioned, the baffle former bolt inspections. Now, one of the things that is giving me confidence is we've consulted with the industry experts. Two, we've done extensive benchmarking in OE. When DC Cook was going through their outage for baffle former bolt inspection and replacement, we sent three separate teams. So I went out there for 9 days. We sent the project team out there for 8 days. And then we sent our RP folks out for a week.
So we got all of their lessons learned. We have actually implemented a biweekly phone call with outage managers. I implemented it with outage managers who have baffle former bolts in their outage, and that was hugely valuable. There's a lot of aha moments for me when I'm talking to the Indian Point guy or the Salem outage manager. There were some key learnings. It's amazing what you can learn in a half an hour phone call.
Do you have other plant representatives going to be here during your work to watch what you're doing?
We have requests out to Indian Point and DC Cook. I haven't gotten a confirmation. I haven't gotten a commitment that they would send somebody out.
Theirs is coming up, and they. I'll put words in your mouth. I assume they'd be welcome if they're going to send somebody.
Oh,
here.
Without a doubt.
Thing you'd be wanting to do.
Yeah, and so for instance, DC Cook, I extended the offer for them to come out because they have another unit that they're going to be doing the baffle former.
DC Cook is in Ohio. For the people that don't know,
Southern Michigan.
I'm sorry, Southern Michigan. Right.
Yeah.
So, excuse me.
Yes.
Southern Michigan. Right.
Luckily,
I am surprised that you're inviting them instead of the other way around. If I were the licensee, I would have the same.
Well,
if I had the same problem, I would come here.
It's two way every way. Everybody
yeah.
can learn.
So we went to DC Cook because just the timing of their outage worked for us. But I'd be more than happy to invite them out because one nice thing about we will be the third or fourth plant. No, we're going to be the fourth plant. Doing this, so we're benefiting from all the lessons learned from the previous outages, from Indian Point, from Salem, from DC Cook. We're also in discussion with Sequoia, who will be doing...
Right. The point is, they are on the facility out there who would benefit from what
yes.
you are doing. Why are they not saying, hey, I'm coming, I am...
That I don't know.
They get
yeah.
to decide.
Yeah, I extended the offer... if they want to take us up on it, they're more than welcome to come out. So.
Which engineering group is responsible for this baffle bolt replacement activity?
For engineering, we have our design engineering who are issuing the modification paperwork because we're actually, when we change bolts, it's a different design bolt. It's a different material and it's different. Mm-hmm. Okay. So we got design engineering. Now, our representative for all the EPRI conferences concerning baffle former bolts, he is our RCS system engineer
yeah.
and extremely knowledgeable.
I'm thinking that we're going to be there in May, which will be in the midst of all of this with the fact-finding, but it might be interesting to just take a look at how that job is going when we're here for the fact-finding, recognizing that we don't want to disrupt the outage, but that's been a long time since I've been able to get into containment during an outage and see things, and it's always really impressive. So.
Yeah, so right now, ballpark, we'd be deploying the bolt replacement machine mm-hmm. tail end of the third week of the outage, so go from April 23rd, 3 weeks in, and as I mentioned, the deployment is currently scheduled for 5 full days. From deployment to actually starting to replace bolts. So we talked about baffle former bolts and deployment and the containment fan cooler cooling coil replacement. We've secured a welding contract. We will be using machine welding. Basically, you set the machine up. But there's a total of 26 welds that need to be performed. Some of those we will prefab prior to the outage. Some we have to actually do in containment.
Is that a hot radioactive environment up there?
No, actually, for the fan coolers, my RP estimates are 0.2 millirem an hour. So even though we're going to spend a lot of hours...
It's not a huge rush concern.
No. Our major ALARA challenge, and we're spending a lot of time and effort and money, is the baffle formal bolt, because there's just going to be a lot of activity and a lot of time spent over the refueling cavity.
I see. Did you say 22 mR per hour?
0.2.
Oh, 0.2.
Yeah, 0.2 mR per hour at fan cooler 1.5.
Yeah, that's nothing.
Yeah, that's not bad. Okay. Our major part...
By the way, the context is you get more than that flying in an airplane.
I'm sorry?
You get more than that per hour flying in an airplane.
That is true. And
it's there, but none of us think that it's particularly...
Unfortunately, you leave your TLD on the ground.
I'm not going to poo-poo it, but it's not something that you say, gee, I'm really going to be
terribly concerned. No, 0.2 is extremely low. So our major partners, Westinghouse, Baffle Former Bolt Inspection and Replacement, Westdyne, which is a subdivision of Westinghouse, is doing a cold leg nozzle inspections. We've used them at least twice on this unit, so they have previous data from previous Unit 1 cold leg nozzle inspections, so that makes it nice. So if depending on what the inspection results, they can go back and look at those historicals.
Is this like ultrasonic? Or
Yes. Okay. So they lower this robot, and for whatever reason it's called a squid, and the robot goes into the cold legs and actually ultrasonically goes around the circumference while the data is being piped via fiber optic back to the analysts. So, cold leg nozzle, or I'm sorry, guide card inspections. Westinghouse did it on Unit 1, and they're back to do it on Unit 2. I'm sorry, they did it on Unit 2. They're back to do it on Unit 1. And Westinghouse will be doing our fuel handling for core offload, core reload, and insert shuffle in the spent fuel pool. Areva will be doing the reactor coolant pump 1-4 motor overhaul. And as usual, Siemens will be doing all of our major turbine generator work. So in closing, this is a unique outage, but I have high confidence that we're going to be successful, primarily because, one, we were lucky to get the operating experience from three other plants. I would hate it. I would have disliked being the first guy to do baffle bolts. And two, the reason I listed the partners is we're bringing some industry expertise. Westinghouse has been doing baffle former bolts not only in the United States but also in Europe. And Areva has done multiple RCPs at places like Callaway and Comanche Peak. Next slide. Questions for me?
A couple questions. We will have a fact-finding meeting there at last week of March. And we'd like to review the outage safety plan when it's ready. Will it be pretty much finalized by that time?
Yes. So we have an industry peer coming in 2 weeks from now. And that's when we do our formal outage safety plan review. SOER 901, that's the shutdown safety info SOER. One of the recommendations we implemented was to bring in an industry peer for a different perspective. So that we will be finalizing the outage safety plan by the first week in March.
Okay, will it be the traditional outage safety plan, or have you got some new things in it?
There are a couple of, I'd call them minor, changes due to the implementation of NFPA 805. Okay. So there are some changes to the outage safety plan when in certain conditions will trigger some fire mitigation activities like verifying automatic suppression or instituting a fire watch.
Mm-hmm. Okay, my second question is, we talked yesterday about asking, and we asked Brian to ask you guys to video record the containment equipment hatch closure exercise.
Oh, the drill?
Drill, yeah.
Okay, we can arrange that. Brian, are you taking notes? So,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, just a heads up. We'd like to,
if it's something that you can do, it'd be great. I mean, if you come back and say, "Gee, you really can't for some reason," we'd like to know.
No, I don't see that being insurmountable. And just to refresh everybody's memory, this is something we implemented before I was the outage manager. I was still in ops. We require a day shift containment closure drill and a night shift containment closure drill, and then we compare those times to time to boil. And we have to have that before we breach the reactor coolant system.
Right.
So
we'll be there May 10 and 11 for another fact-finding meeting, and we'd like to look at the video at that time, if you can do one.
Yeah, we can do that.
Okay.
Brian, just make a note for me to talk to Josh Ernstrom.
We're actually looking forward to that, because that's been on our open items list
to try to observe that, and we realize it's just not going to happen in terms of the alignment of the timing and stuff. So the video should be a good substitute, and then we can check that one off on the open items list of having reviewed it. But I'm curious if we can get in containment in May. There were some modifications, if I remember, made to the equipment hatch closure system to reinforce it for seismic.
Yes.
And that might be something good to look at as well.
Well, one of the reasons it's hard to get you in there to watch it is it's a surprise. So,
that is interesting. That's a good point to make.
So,
a surprise.
just to give you, they know which shift it's going to be on because they have to staff like they would be staffed for containment closure capability. So they know what shift, but. When I was a shift manager, I used to go in and just walk around, and then I'd call my control room and go, okay, initiate it. I used to like to wait till you had the forklift boom through the hatch, so they had to pull it back out.
Good.
So, operations definitely makes it a surprise. We know which shift, but we don't know when.
I think that video will be very entertaining.
Yes, it is. Having watched it personally, I think you'll enjoy it.
Okay.
I got a simple question. Because the outage is this long, there's a whole lot of work that isn't on the critical path, and that means it's not anticipated to be long enough to delay the outage, but it's nevertheless a whole lot of stuff that you're putting in there because it's long. Is there anything in that other work that you're worried could cause some trouble and end up being on the critical path?
I don't think so. And so that was one of the big challenges that I collaborated with the other outage managers. If it wasn't for baffle bolts, our scope of work really does fit in a 33-day schedule. Yeah. So what we've done is all the other work that's not directly impacted by baffle bolts will be done by day 32.
We just saw you at the last fact finding. I asked this question, but I just wanted to ask you again and let the public know that you don't think there's anything else that's likely to. Of course, you never know, but that's jumping up.
No, and again, the main driver to finishing everything in 32 days is the longer you have your staff augmentation, the more money it costs. So the intention is, so if we hit something big, like we got to do a weld overlay or what have you, I still have plenty of recovery time on an emergent basis. But that's one of the reasons we want to get done in 32 days is for discovery. And for all the scope of work in that 32 days, we're still doing the discovery items in the first week.
Right in the beginning.
Right. Sure. But also if you find that your bolts are in good shape and you have a small number that need replacement, then you'll come out of the outage sooner, I assume, right?
Yeah, and one, I think that's a low likelihood, but two, if we have to replace any bolts, just deployment and demobilization is about 11 days of critical path.
You're sort of stuck with that.
Yeah, and so unfortunately, everybody else gets a lot of air cover. So, questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let us welcome public comments on Mr. Carwood's presentation.
David Weissman, Alliance for Nuclear Responsibility. It's not a comment, just a question. When is the next scheduled refueling for Unit 2?
Oh, it's on our schedule here. It's easy to answer.
Okay.
Matt can answer it, or we'll answer it.
February of... 2018, February, yeah. It starts February 4th of 2018.
18
is going to be a two-outage year.
Right.
Spring and fall. That only happens every few years.
Got it. Thank you.
19. Excuse me. 19.
18, then 19.
19
then
is the two-outage
19
year.
Has two.
19 it happens every 3 years when you have a two-outage.
Yeah.
But the next unit, two, is February of 20, a year from now. Okay, thanks.
Yeah, that's the other unit. All right.
Additional public comments on Mr. Carwood's presentation? Hearing none, this is a good time to take the break for lunch, and this meeting will reconvene at 1 p.m. sharp. Dr. Burness? You had a comment, Dr. Burness?
Yeah. we're scheduled after the break, if you see this, to have two more presentations from the PG&E that we asked for. But I want to call your attention to the second of those two. Mike Ginn is going to be here, and he's going to talk about this evaluated exercise. You pretend there's a big accident, and there's an ingestion pathways, which means food and water and so on. And I think that should be of particular interest to members of the public, okay? Because the evaluation of that exercise and how the plan, and we observed, Furman and I were there observing the first day of that. I want to call your attention to that. I think it's particularly an interesting topic.
Okay, that said, let us take a break for lunch and reconvene exactly at 1 p.m. today. Are we ready, Mr. Video? Ladies and gentlemen, could you please take your seat? The committee is about ready to reconvene for our afternoon session. Second day of our 86th annual meeting, annual public meeting. Mr. Kerry Harbour, the floor is yours.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the next speaker that we have for Pacific Gas and Electric is Hector Garcia. He is our Chief Nuclear Officer Support Manager, and he is going to give an overview of our operating plan performance and present that to the committee. Hector has a bachelor's degree in mechanical engineering and has well over 15 years of nuclear experience with leadership roles in engineering as well as the roles that he is in now. Welcome. Hector.
Good afternoon, everybody.
Hi.
As Kerry mentioned, my name is Hector Garcia, and I'm CNO Support Manager at Diablo Canyon Power Plant. And today I will be providing you an update on our operating plan. Next slide, please. So our operating plan is our guide or our roadmap, if you will, to make sure we provide safe and reliable energy to our customers. Our operating plan is a five-year plan that gets updated every year. And today I'm going to discuss the results of our 2016 operating plan and how we did compared to our goals. And I will also touch on some key elements of our 2017 operating plan. Next slide, please. So with safety at the forefront of everything we do, our team will pursue to achieve operational excellence. I know most of you are familiar with the Our Team motto, and Our Team is part of our operating plan, which helps us to operate safely and reliably. Next slide, please. Thank you. So our team is composed of three nuclear tactical focus areas. They are O, outage and online reliability improvement, U, use of human performance tools and performance improvement processes, and R, reinvigorating employee engagement. It also has four strategic focus areas, and the four strategic focus areas are T, transfer and retain critical knowledge, E, enhance our facilities, A, achieve a better work-life balance, and M, maintain safe, reliable, and affordable operations. Next slide, please. So on our focus area O, outage and online reliability improvements, it's really, as the title states, it's focused on our outage and making sure we are reliable online. Our last bullet here on this slide shows that in 2016, we had a very strong refueling outage, and I want to emphasize our safety. We had no recordable and no disabling injuries, and we met our schedule, which shows our schedule performance, and all the work we did for the plant made us reliable throughout last year in 2016. So just like these bullets touch on here for outage and online reliability, it's really overall focus is personnel and nuclear safety and improved outage scheduling and resource loading. Next slide, please. For the focus area U, which is a use of human performance tools and performance improvement processes, one of the bullets that I want to touch on is the first one, which says leverage leadership in the field to engage our team and eliminate barriers to performing work. Another benefit of having our leaders in the field are they are reinforcing our standards, they are promoting safety, and they are really building those relationships with our employees, which is going to be key, and I'll touch on that a little later on today. It also has an emphasis on our human performance tools, and the results from this focus area here are they resulted in zero site-level human performance errors and no lost time injuries last year. Next slide, please. R is reinvigorating employee engagement. So last year, we had two site alignment workshops. As the third bullet states, we leveraged those workshops, to make sure our employees were engaged and aligned. And we also had crucial conversations training that reinforces the behaviors and improves our safety culture at the plant. And we reinforce facilitative leadership behaviors that focus on tapping the power of participation. Yes, sir.
I understand those words, and we've been on fact-finding and talked to you and others about it. So,
oops. Have this on. I understand the words, and we've fact-findings have talked to you and a lot of your colleagues about that. And it sounds great, good for you, but I don't know. I don't have any idea how you measure the third one. That is employee engagement. I mean, it's qualitative.
Right.
I mean, I understand how you measure. You didn't have any report, any lost time injuries. Good for you. I mean, that's a major goal that every industrial facility has, and that's great. But I don't know how you measure this, and I wonder whether you have some way of knowing whether those things are effective or there's some other way to do it or you've changed it because it isn't or what.
So that's a good question. We're implementing actually a couple of committees on the plant that focus on having diverse set of groups, maybe from engineering, maintenance, and operations. And the main purpose of this committee is employee engagement. So what their purpose is, to meet, get together, and talk about their groups on how their employees are, whether they're engaged. Another bullet that I would mention on that is having results on surveys where we actually ask our employees to rate themselves as well as the leaders on how engaged our employees are. And just like you mentioned, which is the last bullet I was going to get to, when you have engaged employees, they result in overall safe, reliable planned operations, which our last bullet shows. It shows by your employees being engaged, they're not committing any human performance errors, they're doing what they need to do, and they're at work focused on the job at hand.
I mean, my problem, and I'm not complaining, I'm just saying my problem is that when I think about the word engaged, there are some people whose personality is naturally going to lead them to become more engaged with their colleagues and the environment than others, and those aren't necessarily different classes of performance. I mean, there are introverted people whose performance is fabulous, and there are extroverted people whose performance is lousy, and on the face of it, you'd think the extroverted people would be more engaged.
Right.
So I'm wondering about whether you and your colleagues, and we've had fact findings about this, and I've talked about this before, have any more than just a qualitative way to understand whether that, you know, what that means, how it's working.
So to answer that question,
besides measuring that you have zero injuries or something, I understand that.
So we're continuing to, just like you're mentioning, trying to find other ways of demonstrating that. But I think the key point here is, and when I had my team, the way that you could gauge your employees are engaged is by building that relationship. I touched on it, on having leaders in the field, but if you don't build that relationship, that's really the foundation. You get to know your employees, you know how they work, you know when they're there at work, and you know what really helps them to achieve performance. So I think our first bullet here, having our leaders actually build that relationship with the employees, that really engages our workforce. So
let me pursue this, because I'm puzzled, but I'm going to try to pursue it with you. What would the opposite of engaged be? And don't use disengaged. Would it, in a sense, you might think it's isolated as opposed to engaged. That an employee that's isolated from his or her colleagues wouldn't be engaged. But I'm just wondering,
it means to me, I'll take a stab at answering that question. What it means to me would be, and as an example just for everyone here, is if we have a meeting where you have an employee that attends the meeting, he's paying attention or looks at the presentation, but he really doesn't say anything throughout the presentation. He doesn't really ask questions. He doesn't really show what he's going to take from this presentation and do with it. So that's what I would say a non-engaged employee would be.
Yeah, I'd like to add something to that. So, Bob, I think you're probing at some good things, and as you know, there is no perfect, you know, engagement meter. But, you know, when I think about it in terms of what we like to see with respect to engagement, and I was talking to Sherry Lewis about this at lunch, what we look for is ownership. And ownership can show up in a number of ways.
Engaged
employee is really about an employee that really owns the core of not only just the activities that they do, but the success of the plant. And where we see that is in things we mentioned earlier there is typically about 18,000 to 20,000 corrective action program documents initiated. It takes ownership for someone to say, hey, you know what, I see a problem. I want to see if I can make this right. And so we monitor things like are people initiating things into the corrective action program? When we have challenges at the plant, do we have people that are ready to respond? Do they come to the table, you know, willingly and say, hey, you know what, hey, I need to be a part of this solution and try to see if we can help us to engage? When we get ready to identify things that we need to put into our operating plan, do we have people that stand up to the table and go, hey, here's something that we might want to do? So we look for our various means of those type of things, and that really is, as I was talking with Sherry, that really is the strength of an organization, is when you get the as maximum amount of ownership, that helps you to be able to achieve those other results.
Well, I understand. Ownership is a word we didn't use when I was a kid, but I understand it. It's the concept of responsibility for your not only your assignment, but the things that your assignment touches on. I understand that. Good for you. But there's a danger that thinking about the word engaged in terms of such things as do they chime in a lot at meetings, maybe prejudicing yourself against the introverted person who's absolutely fabulous.
Yes.
And has ownership. And so I think there's a trap in sort of typing personalities in the wrong way.
I would agree with you. Each different type of personality could show up differently. So like you said, an introvert could just be absorbing everything in the meeting and then comes back later. So it's not all just about the meeting performance, but it's about those other things.
Yeah,
we have introverts that will back away and come back, hey, you know what, I think I found the solution to this problem. Let me go and help.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Next slide, please. So our tactical areas, I'll start with them with the T, which is transfer and retain critical knowledge. So we're continuing to gauge our workforce and capture key knowledge and skills utilizing our routine plant processes. What that means is we're continuously updating our plant procedures. What I will mention as well is we are actually adding tacit or unknown knowledge into our knowledge transfer process, and we're actually leveraging technology. And a couple of examples of leveraging technology for retaining critical knowledge is we started a wiki application, which is similar to our wiki on site like Wikipedia, where it's an application where people can update it on knowledge transfer items, and it continuously gets updated to provide knowledge transfer information. We're also leveraging technology with doing videos with best practices on how to. So, for example, an example could be how to change a seal on a pump. We actually do videos on that, and we're actually leveraging technology for that. So that's T. For E, enhancing our facilities, we're continuously implementing our plan to address improvements in our facilities. And what that means is looking for all the spaces that our employees are at to make sure they're efficient to getting their work done. And some examples that we've done is we remodeled the canyon room at the facility, as well as did some remodeling to the maintenance building shop for the offices of our employees. Our next item is A, achieve a better work-life balance. So this is really around reducing the overtime of our employees to make sure that they are able to spend time with their families. We know that could be a challenge at times, but we want to make sure this is a focus area, because by having employees with a better work-life balance, they'll also be more engaged when they're on site. So one of the items we did is we measured our overtime from last year, and we reduced overtime by 2% last year. M puts it all together. M is maintain safe, reliable, and affordable operations. It really looks at doing everything we can and do it safely, reliably, and affordably. And what we leveraged here was our corrective action program. And what we really wanted to do was whenever we had events, we wanted to make sure we resolved them correctly to prevent any recurring events. Next slide, please. So now I'm going to get into the results. So this is on safety and human performance. As you can see by this slide, all our results in 2016 surpassed our goals in safety and human performance. So the indicators we used are total industrial safety accident rate. I know most of you know the definition, but for the benefit of everyone here, that's the number of accidents resulting in lost work for every 200,000 work hours. And human performance station clock reset, it's the rate of human performance events that meet clock reset criteria. So we exceeded our goals, which I want to emphasize here on safety, and we exceeded the goals that were top tier quartile performance. So those goals were set based on top quartile performance, and we exceeded those in safety last year.
A quick question. Could you describe what the statistics are for other industries in this area?
So for other industries, and kind of like I mentioned, for example, on total industrial safety accident rate, that is top quartile for 0.02. So second quartile performance, for example, would be like a 0.3.
I'm thinking of other industries such as, say, manufacturing or mining or...
Yes. This actually, and that's a great question, just to put everything in perspective in terms of nuclear. These numbers that you see here are to the power of 10 in terms of safe, a lot more safe than, like you mentioned, mining. I used to work at a refinery at Chevron in El Segundo. And just in terms of safety overall, these numbers are a lot better in terms of factors to the 10 than other industries. Mm-hmm. Next slide, please. So plant reliability and outage performance. So a lot of these indicators that I'm going to touch here, I want to make sure I briefly go over the definition. So equipment reliability index. That's the measure used to gauge the health of equipment to ensure safe and reliable operations. And force loss rate is the ratio of unplanned generation losses during a given period to the reference generation. As you can see by all our actuals, last year we exceeded all our goals shown here in terms of equipment reliability, force loss rate, and refueling outage duration. I did mention one of the focus areas was refueling outage. Not only did we exceed the duration, we had no safety events, no recordable injuries, no disabling injuries, and no station-level events, which is key. Next slide, please.
Now, Mr. Garcia, on this slide, when you talk about equipment, I would assume you lump every piece of equipment under the program. It's a broad spectrum of a lot of equipment.
So you're correct. In Equipment Reliability Index, it does look at a lot of equipment, but it actually looks at and focuses a lot on the safety equipment that's required for safe and reliable operations.
So mostly these are safety equipment.
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. Next slide, please. So our plant performance index and NRC metrics are results from last year. We did not meet these two indicators. And the reason that we did not meet these two indicators, it is based on the white finding that we received, and I understand that Mr. Baldwin had a presentation earlier today on that white finding. So that's the reason we didn't meet our DCPP Reliability and Safety Indicator Index, and it's really an industry benchmark composed of 12 components used to gauge performance reset criteria, and our NRC performance indicators and findings are inputs used to determine the licensee's performance. So we had no cross-cutting issues. We did meet that, but as you're aware of, Unit 2 came in Column 2, and Unit 1 came in Column 1. Next slide, please. So what else happened last year? We had a record-setting year last year in terms of net generation and capacity factors ever at the facility. So we had our highest ever Unit 1 annual record and our highest ever DCPP combined annual record. But what's really important here is we did it safely. We did it without any injuries during an outage, like I mentioned, no recordable, no disabling, and we did it with a zero total industrial safety accident rate. So that's what's really impressive there. We did it safely, and just to refresh everyone on the definition of capacity factor, it's the ratio of generation output over a period of time to the potential continuous output. Next slide, please. So in summary, last year, I want to reemphasize, we really did a great job in terms of safety. We had a strong employee focus on employee engagement and continuously improving. We had strong personnel, safety, and plant reliability and outage performance to support our customers. And we want to have a continued focus in 2017 and continue engaging our team and further enhancing our performance. Next slide, please. So what's up for 2017? So our operating plan for 2017 is currently being constructed, but I can share with you that key elements are going to continue to be safety, which is on the forefront, reliability, affordability, employee engagement, and compliance. And
what do you mean by affordability?
So affordability, what I mean by that is you're aware of, in the nuclear industry, we want to make sure that our key areas, and one of the key areas for Pacific Gas and Electric Company, is to do everything safely, reliably, and affordably. And what that means is to making sure that we are competitive with other industry nuclear benchmark in terms of pricing.
So one measure would be cents per kilowatt hour?
Yes, dollars per megawatt hour, yes. Next slide, please. And that's what I had for my presentation.
Committee member remarks? So let's welcome public comments on Mr. Garcia's presentation.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you. There being none, Mr. Harbour.
Okay, thanks again, Mr. Chairman. So our final presentation for this afternoon session will be on the topic of emergency preparedness and the evaluated exercise that we completed recently. Very extensive exercise, and so we have our emergency planning manager, Mike Jin, is going to go through that with the committee. And Mike has well over 25 years of nuclear experience, a significant amount of that in the emergency planning area. And with that, I'm going to hand it over to Mike to walk us through.
Thank you, Kerry. Members of the committee, how are you this afternoon? Like Kerry said, next slide, Brian, thank you. In November 2016, we had quite an extensive evaluated exercise, emergency preparedness exercise. And I'll walk you through some of the highlights of that exercise, results, strengths, areas for improvement, and goals, participants. Thanks. The purpose of the exercise was to evaluate our emergency response organizations and agencies, both on-site and off-site, and our ability to implement the stations and the government agencies' emergency plans and procedures to protect the health and safety of the public. We're focused on evaluating the effectiveness of our emergency response facilities, the equipment and supplies needed and tested to implement that goal to protect health and safety of the public if an emergency were to occur at the facility. Next slide. The exercise was several days in duration and included multiple scenario events to test and challenge emergency responders. Day one included a scenario requiring a full activation of all of the PG&E on-site and off-site facilities, several facilities. I got some photos coming up to give you an idea. Over 500, I think realistically it's close to 1,000 exercise participants.
That's hard to believe.
Over the 3 days.
I mean, it's still hard to believe.
I know it is.
There were a lot of folks out there. We were there.
It's quite an extensive project to implement. The exercise we started 2 years out working with the state of California and San Luis Obispo County on just the planning for the exercise. And you can see on day two and three we had several other focused demonstrations around protection of the health and safety of the public for a recovery and reentry ingestion pathway focus. So there were multiple additional counties other than San Luis Obispo that participated on days two and three, extensive participation from federal and state agencies as well on those scenario events. Next slide. So the summary of performance verified through the NRC, Nuclear Regulatory Commission inspection and Federal Emergency Management Agency evaluation, and I'll share additional information coming up on their insights, demonstrated our ability to protect the health and safety of the public through the reasonable assurance verification. And so that was really the focus of the exercise, to come away evaluated through objectives or and all the demonstration criteria that we use to judge the performance of the emergency responders to protect plant employees and the public. And that photo, going back real quick, is just one of the snapshots from the actual exercise where our Technical Support Center Command and Control, titled the Site Emergency Coordinator, is being reviewed by NRC inspectors and peer controllers and evaluators on his ability to complete a notification form in a timely manner and then get that information out to government agencies on the status of the response to the scenario events. Thanks, Brian. We also demonstrated in the emergency operations facility offsite our ability to really integrate PG&E's emergency plan into the county and the state's emergency plans with that face-to-face communication capability out at the Kansas Avenue in San Luis Obispo. There's a photo of our emergency director, station director, Paula Gerfen, who's here earlier today. Participated in the exercise in a command function out at the EOF. And then also our Joint Information Center. I know many members of the committee have been to that facility and to the EOF before to see those demonstrations. Federal, state, county, and utility spokespersons working jointly together to provide information to the public on events and response. Thanks. So these are some of the strengths that were identified during the exercise by specific facilities that we activated, including the control room simulator, the on-site facilities, the technical support center, operational support center, EOF, the Joint Information Center, and then also our unified facility that is really focused on protective action recommendations, meteorological conditions, and that's the Unified Dose Assessment Center. So we saw across all facilities very timely augmentation. It was a response required scenario where real activation to the facility upon notification was evaluated. And so the facilities were staffed and activated in a timely manner. And then we saw good command and control and then also timely dispatch of personnel into the field to address the scenario events. Next slide. These are some insights from our NRC inspectors. We had a team of five NRC inspectors, including representation from NRC headquarters and NRC Region 4. And the five inspectors were, I know you saw them in the field that day, but were across all facilities doing independent evaluations and inspections in each of the facilities. These are some of the insights provided by the NRC inspectors during the exit. The exercise resulted in no violations, no findings, no areas of significant issues identified by the regulator. My team and the emergency response organization, folks like Carrie and Brian, who actually serve on teams for the emergency response organization, conducted very self-critical critiques, and several corrective actions were identified to continuously improve our response. These are just some of the insights that were provided to us from the NRC during the exit. Next slide.
Oh, wait, don't go by that. First one, so there's an accident, and PG employees are supposed to administer potassium iodide to themselves so as to protect themselves, and an employee says no. That's what this is about. And you don't have a written procedure about...
No, we sure do, sir. We have a procedure.
That's what I thought. So what does this say?
We do advanced planning on potassium iodide with regards to making a decision for administering the KI.
I understood that.
And just having the decision makers familiar with responsibilities if employees shouldn't, maybe they're allergic to potassium iodide or refuse to take potassium iodide. For someone like me, over 40, right, I'm not allergic to shellfish or potassium iodide, but the benefits may not be as significant for protection. However, the procedure guidelines are more focused on just the administering of it, not so much the contingency of finding alternate personnel if needed. We have those processes in place, but what to do should you remove an individual if someone refuses to take KI?
Okay, the thing that I misunderstood. I understand it now. Wouldn't you think that you might survey all your employees, and if he got a zillion of them, that perhaps there's a very small number that are allergic, and you could know that in advance, and then you wouldn't have to cross that at the time.
Yes, and we do that through training. Okay. And we do self-identify and then identify in advance.
So it'd be that sort of thing.
Personnel, correct, yeah. It may be a known, you may have certain circumstances where individuals are not capable of wearing a respirator or self-contained breathing apparatus.
That's right.
Or taking potassium iodide.
There's a set of things like
we
that.
We do screen employees through training and awareness that let us know and let the leadership know. This was a scenario discussion where, your procedure's pretty good in administering KI. Maybe improve it by building in some contingencies on what actions to take specific for decision makers should someone refuse to take it or maybe not be capable of taking the prophylactic. Any other questions on the
no, that's fine.
Insights? There's several. I know we've shared our report and during the fact-finding got into some of the details on various areas.
For those of you know, Furman and I talked to Mike as recently as only just 2.5 weeks ago. I mean, we were...
Correct. So I wanted to spend some time on these next couple of slides because this really is, if you look at the federal regulations with regards to risk significance for protection and the health and safety of the public, which is our mission, those regulations are built around classify, notify, assess, and protect. Those are the four risk significant planning standard or regulations that we really focus on with regards to our performance. So the roll-up of the classifications, notifications, protective action recommendations, and then the notification to the state and government agencies, the county, on those notifications were evaluated by PG&E, but also by the NRC, and each of the events came came out to be timely and accurate. So there's a lot of work and focus that goes into making sure your risk significant performance is 100%. So the team performed well with regards to that risk significant area. Next slide gives you a little bit more detail on the classifications. You can see we had a very challenging scenario for the emergency responders on day one, where we actually went through from an alert to a general emergency, three classifications within just a few hours. So not necessarily an event that you would see, but we needed to challenge the emergency response organization and then also drive the scenario for day two and day three demonstrations as well. But the events there give you a classification time, who it was classified by in the facility, what the classification level was. And, of course, those classification levels there, universal across the industry, they really drive alert, site area, or general, all of the off-site standard operating procedures and response. So once you enter that condition and communicate that and notify it to the state and the county, they have several activities and responsibilities that they're required to implement at those classifications. So the key is timely classification, and then the next slide is timely notification.
Could you just briefly summarize what in this scenario was the satisfied ended up being the parts of the scenario that satisfied the criteria to go from alert to site area emergency and then for transition from site area to general? Yeah. For this specific scenario.
Yeah, I can give you the details
and
here.
And maybe talk a little bit about how those decisions are made and what the criteria are that cause you to move from one status to the next.
Sure. We have emergency action levels that are triggers based upon initiating conditions, plan enunciators, plan equipment, even field reports. From radiation protection or security or fire protection personnel that would prompt our operations shift managers, shift foremen to review the event, determine if they need to enter the station's emergency plan, which is a significant formal process. Carrie used to have that role and responsibility. And during your career as a shift foreman or shift manager, you may never get an opportunity to enter the emergency plan, you know, for an unusual event or alert. But
there's been one alert at the plant in its history. Is that correct, I think?
Yes, we had an alert.
So you've done it once.
Yeah, basically. It was one, but it was due to a CO2 release in a diesel generator, so no impacts to the to the health and safety of the public.
Correct. But they do receive rigorous training, the operators, every 5 weeks, coming off crew, getting tested on their ability to respond to those scenarios. So folks like Carrie are tested, and really their license is on the line with regards to their ability to successfully implement the emergency plan for a scenario. And you can see with the facility we have up there is a control room. It's actually the simulator, right? So that's where we just like our emergency response facilities, the simulator is one of our emergency response facilities. The control room is one of the most important emergency response facilities we have, but we try not to bother them during an exercise or drill.
So, Pierre, in this particular scenario, the first alert was determined when they had discovered failed fuel. They have a matrix of different things happening in the plant. It tells them to go to what classification, what emergency classification. That was the first one. And they activated facilities on that alert. And I think the second one, which was the site area emergency, I think that was initiated on the containment leak.
That's correct. I believe
that's correct. And then the general emergency was declared based on
fission product barrier.
You're right, fission product barrier being lost.
Matrix.
Wait up.
I thought that the general emergency was when the containment was no longer
loss of
a full barrier.
Yeah, loss of two, potential loss of third. bidding product
area.
That's
the general emergency. The site air emergency was when they had the loss of coolant accident, I believe.
Yeah.
Quick moving scenario and very challenging.
When they detected radioactivity.
That's right.
Right. And you can see the events were classified, and we give them 15 minutes to get it right, right, with regards to if it's not done within 15 minutes, it's a fail, even if they get the right answer. So that's timely and accuracy that we're looking for. The next slide takes each of the events that was classified and then starts an independent clock for how quickly do we complete the documentation, make the formal declaration, make the plan announcements, and notify the state and the county of those declared events. So we have, again, 15 minutes to get that completed. And that is, again, timely and accurate is what we're looking for. So we review those forms that are completed during these scenarios, and so doesn't the NRC. One error on the form of an accuracy field would contribute to a missed performance indicator or a failed objective. So the results of this exercise with the focus of the emergency response organization was 10 for 10, which is what you really are shooting for with regards to risk significant performance. I think the next slide might, kind of gets into some of the offsite participation and the results from day two and day three.
Now, Mr. Jin, if I may go back one slide. On the comment section, you're talking about shift manager actions prior to alert declaration. What action are you talking about?
Yes, slide prior to that.
Right.
So the note there is the shift manager actually took very good action to communicate to the ops crew on the simulator that we hadn't declared an event yet, but we met the condition for his evaluation, and then also provided upgrade criteria, what they're looking for from the control board operators. So what we felt that, we put that in the notes as a strength, the shift manager actions prior to the actual alert declaration was communicating to the crew that he was evaluating this event for emergency plan entry, and then what he needed the crew to look for with regards to the potential for upgrade criteria.
So that contributed to the timeliness success.
It's critical.
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Question. The second note there talks about independent peer checks. Who and how do you do your independent checks on classifications?
Sure. If you're in the control room and you're the shift manager, you get an independent verification from another qualified senior reactor operator. So it's either going to be the shift technical advisor, SRO, Unit 1 or Unit 2 shift foreman. We have four SROs on crew at all time. So the key there is no one individual makes a determination for an event without another similar qualified individual providing an independent, really independent from your answer, recommendation to where they think you need to be with regards to that classification. Offsite, we have that same process for the emergency operations facility where the emergency director has the site emergency coordinator on site, equally trained and qualified. Both have that non-delegable responsibility for classify, notify, assess, or protect. And the emergency director offsite is trained to get a second brain, a second check with regards to independent, a whole nother team looking at the event and giving the recommendation for where they believe they are. And that's all done within that 15 minutes. Next slide. I think I'm finally to the, wanted to spend just a few minutes. We recently received the after action report from the Federal Emergency Management Agency, which is really focused on day two and day three. Also day one response by the numerous agencies that we had worked with over the months and years to prepare for this exercise. So these are kind of slides that FEMA used during the public meeting exit the week of the exercise. So we had 22 FEMA evaluators that came out to observe the off-site response organizations play. And, of course, PG&E is integrated in a lot of these activities as well. So each evaluator had, the team looked at over 175 specific exercise criteria. And then typically each criteria, there's a requirement for 10 to 25 points to review. And then they do work through a written report or narrative for each of those areas that they evaluate. The FEMA categorizes their exercise results as level one, level two, or planning issues. And for day one demonstration and the offsite response, no areas of concern, level one, level two, or planning issues were identified. Basically, FEMA's determination is similar to the NRC. They reference 44 CFR 350, a different code of federal regulations than ours, but to make their determination with regards to was reasonable assurance, high assurance, verified that public health and safety would have been protected based upon their evaluations. And they made that determination that yes.
Well, Mr. Jean, how does the FEMA standard and process compare to the NRC Chapter 10 regulation?
Sure. The NRC evaluation or inspection team is smaller, and they're really focused on those risk-significant planning areas primarily. However, they do integrate the senior resident inspector or resident inspector into their team to expand their team a bit. But for FEMA, you have 22 evaluators spread all throughout the county, and they're looking for consistency in the National Incident Management System response to the event, who's in command and control, can the county implement decisions from the recommendations that the utility provides. So they look at their ability to implement those decisions, which would protect the health and safety of the public, by making notifications to the public, evacuation orders if needed, taking advance actions to reduce the outdoor recreational population. Those types of evaluations are what FEMA is looking at.
So this is really providing another level of protection from FEMA. It's very, another dimensional.
Very comprehensive, yeah. And these are folks that evaluate emergency exercises across the country. So they see other government agencies, states and counties, and public safety agencies implementing similar responsibilities. So a lot of times they come and they provide good insights with regards to benchmarks that we can learn from. They love coming to San Luis Obispo. The San Luis Obispo County Office of Emergency Services has a great team, and of course, you know, the response. I think your job as an evaluator is easier if the performance is strong, rather than if maybe you're evaluating a really challenging performance where there are a lot of issues, errors. You're going to have quite an extensive report to write, right? So, but yeah, not only did FEMA look at public health and safety protection, they also spent the day two and day three focused on how did the Federal Radiological Monitoring and Assessment Center, state health, state agencies from emergency services integrate into the local response for the protection of food, water, agriculture, and then also recovery for previously simulated evacuated areas.
Can you walk us through one particular thing? I just want you to imagine. I'm a dairy farmer somewhere in the county, and this release would threaten my dairy cattle. So as I understand it, somebody has to tell that dairy farmer to bring the cattle indoors and be sure they're on feed that has been harvested a long time ago so that they're not out there eating the grass that might have been contaminated now. So that farmer has to get this thing. What's the process by which that information, there are three or four agencies involved before that farmer gets that thing. Can you walk us through that? We start with the county is told, Ron Alsop and his colleagues, and the other agencies are told there's a release.
Sure.
And it's heading northwest or something. So go ahead.
They're evaluating meteorological conditions.
But then, so how do these other agencies go ahead?
Well, I wanted to say that one of the first things that we do is we start with public education in advance of any event. So if you look at we have a specific brochure for the agricultural community. So we use that information both in English and Spanish and provide it to,
say, my
farmers,
dairy farmer.
Agriculture.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, in advance through the agricultural departments, the folks that they're used to working with.
Is this the state ag or the county?
Both state and local.
Okay.
Yeah, and multiple counties too. Remember, you're in the Santa Barbara County.
Thank you.
And beyond.
Okay.
So we start that process with public education in advance of an event.
Okay.
And our calendar that's published recently for 2017. I should have brought some for y'all if you hadn't received one. Also has the similar information in it for those individuals.
Right, so now we have this event, and who tells what how? How does this all work?
Yeah, the Unified Dose Assessment Center that I mentioned is really a unified a group of agencies. So it's not just PG&E evaluating the environmental impacts or conditions. It's representatives from federal government, state, and county that are there in the unified facility off of the EOF. And even early on, there are recommendations that are made by that Unified Dose Assessment Center for protection of livestock, poultry, and even crops, mostly livestock with regards to sheltered stored feed recommendations. And then the other exercises that we demonstrated on day two and day three were bringing together responders that would typically be here 4 to 6 to 12 hours later, and really integrating them into our response. So you have the Federal Radiological Monitoring and Assessment Center capabilities, which is the federal government, Department of Energy's ability to assist the locals and the states with protective action recommendation development from flyovers and evaluations in the field, those field demonstrations. And that those were integrated on day three with a decision maker tabletop. So you have the department heads from the state and the leaders from the various counties that are impacted working together to review those recommendations and making decisions to protect water, food, crops, and that's what we demonstrated on those additional days. Next slide, Brian. This is just a quick reference of participating agencies locally here, included Pismo Beach, APCD, we call them Air Pollution Control District. They actually have a function in the Unified Dose Assessment Center, and then also Port San Luis just down the road. Next. These are some of the agencies that participated both on day one and day two and three, and they're the state agencies, other counties that participated, and then the really multiple federal agencies that come out for these ingestion pathway exercises, EPA, Department of Energy, just a few. I think that's all the slides that I had for you. I'd be happy to answer any additional questions that you have.
Committee members, remarks?
Anybody?
Thank you.
Thank you very much, and let us entertain public comments on Mr. Jean's presentation.
Good afternoon, David Weissman for the Alliance for Nuclear Responsibility. I'd just like to know, and maybe Mr. Harbert knows, how and when would we be able to get a download, an electronic version of the PowerPoint that we just, this particular one?
Of these PowerPoints?
No, just this one in particular, but yeah. Is it on your website? Is it from PG&E? Is there any way we could get I could scan every page, but it would be easier to just...
Brian provides me all the PowerPoints after the meeting, and then you could get them from
They'll
us.
They'll be David. Up on your website. Okay.
Actually, no, we don't really put them on our website, but we can provide them to you.
Oh, okay. I'll just remember to send you an email.
There's
back.
Nothing here that isn't in the public domain.
Exactly.
Oh, no, but to that effect, but I've seldom seen it for the purposes of our interest so concisely and nicely put all
that's
into one place. You must know that...
this is important because as part of the joint proposal, PG&E has made this commitment to maintain this level of emergency response through the termination of the Part 50 license. And I think there may be participants and people involved in the joint proposal that they're confused about what Part 50 license means, and this might be a very helpful way to explain what is going to be the type of activities, and to the county who will be receiving as part of this the compensation for their share of emergency services, just what it is they're getting.
Well, just to say, Furman and I met with Mike, what, a little less than 3 weeks ago, and we asked him that question. He's standing right here, and he said, yes, he will deal not again, that it is his group's intent that they will be here through the end of the, not just when the reactor stops running, but through the end of the period, as long as there's radioactive materials on the site.
Right.
And Michael just nodded that that's so, because they've made that commitment, is that?
Oh, no, we were very aware, we were there at the inception. So the point is, though, there may be other people who are constituents of ours as a nonprofit who don't quite understand what that part is, and the ability to
fair
share
enough
something that's as easily digestible as this helps explain
that's
just what it is going forward. Thank you.
Yeah.
Additional public comments on Mr. Jean's presentation. There being none, our next and last items on our agenda will be committee.
Thank you, Mike. Nice work. By the way, hundreds and hundreds of people, it's a coordination nightmare. And in a real event, it would be worse because there would be more.
Thank you, Dr. Butness. The last and the next item, or the next and the last item on our agenda will be concluding remarks by committee members. Dr. Peterson, Dr. Butness.
Concluding remarks.
Well, then let me, on behalf of the committee, express our appreciation to members of the public who participate in this 86th public meeting of the Diablo Canyon Independent Safety Committee. Our appreciation to senior management of PG&E, Director Carrie Harbour, Manager Brian McKay, and our appreciation to the audio and video specialists. Did I miss anything, Dr. Burns?
Go ahead.
I just wanted to ask, yesterday we had a discussion about tentative dates stretching out over next year of possible meetings and fact findings and the like, and I don't want to put Brian on the spot, but if you have any feedback from the plan as to whether there's any issues, if not, we'll learn later, just so it's for planning purposes.
Yeah, correct. I took an action to look at the plant 2018 calendar.
We just want to
go forward and confirm dates.
We don't need to have it in the next few minutes, but just so that action will come to us sooner.
Correct. I'll be sending it through, Bob.
The one thing that's firm, though, is our next public meeting is in June, and that's firm. For the public. Okay.
There being no additional business on the committee's agenda.
June 7 and June 8.
Yes, indeed. No additional business on the committee's agenda. So the 86th public meeting of the Diablo Canyon Independent Safety Committee will now be adjourned. Thank you very much.
At 1:57.